You're listening to the Tech Gaming Podcast, episode 12-4. I'm your host, Robert Desert Eagle Allen. With me tonight is Eric Blue Swim.
Hey, that's me.
And Jeremy Lawman Lamont.
Hidey-ho, neighbors.
And not with us tonight, Sean Shanola Kirkland, who's out on business, and Sage Samarage Morris Green, who might be joining us later.
Yay.
So, yeah, good stuff. So before we get to our impressions, one of the things I wanted to do is take a moment to talk about a little bit of sad news that occurred today. It was announced that Sony made a friendly split with Superbot, the creators of PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, and with many expecting this studio to suffer some repercussions, either have a layoff or possibly even close its doors. Now, the move wasn't totally unexpected. Number of people, our listeners, my co-host, have discussed Sony's rather weak marketing efforts for the title. And number of people are thinking that when Sly Cooper, Thieves of Time, is released later this week, with little or no fanfare, that this incident may be repeated. So what are your reactions, guys? Let's start with you, Jeremy, because I know along with me, you really enjoyed PlayStation All-Stars.
Yeah, I do. I definitely do. And I think that if you're listening to this, you may also enjoy PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale. I agree that it is unfortunate. And, I certainly hope that that the folks over there are going to do all right. I believe there were some layoffs with this as well. But, you know, it kind of strikes me that I don't know that this is really all that unusual these days, and I'm not even just necessarily talking about sales success or not. It kind of strikes me a little bit more as kind of the natural progression or the natural ending. I mean, like you said, it's an amicable split. I'm assuming that they probably had planned on this sort of thing. Generally when production ramps down on a title, I mean, when they are finished with their work on a particular title. And the other thing too is that DLC is going to be continuing for this game. So I know we've got some coming out probably any day now. You know, we've talked in the past about Kat from Gravity Rush and Emmett from Starhawk. I think there may be some reasonable expectation that there will be at least some DLC, going forward. But that stuff is going to be handled by Sony Santa Monica, who had worked with Superbot on the game. There's also, come to think of it, the what's the name of the studio that did the Vita version as well? Blue Point? Does that sound right?
Sounds about right. I totally neglected mentioning their name, but they did an exceptional job.
Yeah, it's an awesome port. But regardless of whether it does well sales-wise, which, you know, I doubt it really set the world on fire or not, at some point their work on that title, you know, comes to an end. And if Sony have an internal studio like the Santa Monica studio who can handle, you know, the smaller and more focused, support on the product from that point, I suspect that that's probably, you know, the way that things go.
Yeah. I think the nature of the game is changing. Publishers obviously are looking for, when they release a full price $60 product, they are looking for, you know, sales in it of at least a million. And when that doesn't happen, they seem to, you know, kind of scrap the studio. And, I don't mean to sound crass, but I think these layoffs are a result of the way business is done. A project, occurs, and if the results don't pan out, then people are let go, and hopefully a lot of them, as we saw with Vigil, might be picked up by a new studio. I know Platinum was courting them. And, you know, the results are repeated. And as such, I think we're seeing a trend where people are more contract workers rather than company employees. And I know that probably isn't much consolation, and that probably doesn't make for a rewarding, you know, stable lifestyle, but that seems to be the way the business is going.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I don't know that that's really a surprise or, you know, for CEOs or for the producers or the financial people who look at it and say, oh my God, we've got to cut these people. I think that that's probably more the way that they plan it out to be from the beginning. I mean, from a financial standpoint, and, you know, like you said, I don't want to be heartless or anything about it, but if you can have a specialized, focused team of people, if you outsource, you know, for art assets or engineering or something like that, why maintain a staff of people that, you know, potentially are more expensive when you can do the same job with a focused group of people, and when they get that piece done, then, you know, that's all you needed them for. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the, you know, there have been, like we said earlier, I mean, there were layoffs associated with this, and, you know, whether or not you see it coming from a mile away, it's certainly not fun to lose your job. So, no. Certainly we hope that the folks over at Superbot and anybody else involved are, you know, working on, and you know, these guys too, they generally will have a lot of irons in the fire anyway. So as you ramp down on a particular project, it's more than likely, I mean, they always have ideas. They've got two or three things that they plan on working on, you know, going forward. So I don't think there's any, you know, doubt that we'll be seeing something from Superbot here again in the near future. So,
And the one thing that's kind of puzzling, I don't want to paint the picture of Sony being the bad guy, but obviously they spent a lot of money. They created, you know, Superbot, the studio. And then we both got the feeling, I think, Jeremy, you agree, that they didn't put the marketing push behind the title as well as they could.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. And like you said, I mean,
it seems strange to put so much money in and that not follow through.
Yeah, that is weird, and that is something that I don't, you know, I don't pretend to have any special corporate knowledge about these sorts of things, and it is weird that you would go through the expense. I do believe one thing, and this may be, you know, cynical or not, you know, whatever you think. I believe that the financial success of almost anything, you know, whether it's a video game or a movie, is in the marketing, is in the money that you spend in the marketing, not necessarily in the production of the thing. And you're right. I mean, it's a big investment to have a studio and to put, you know, all those man hours and years into something, and then to just sort of let it fly and not really do anything with it. You can expect some word of mouth, but you really have to let people know, hey, this is out there and it's good. And, you know, so like I said, if you're listening to this, you might find yourself enjoying PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale. It's probably won't help anybody over at Superbot at this point, but I think they can be proud of the work that they've done. And like I said, we look forward to whatever it is that's coming next from them.
Yeah. And hopefully the Spectre won't hang over them on the purported PS4 announcement later this month.
Well, we don't know that.
Wall Street Journal confirmed it. So.
Did they actually confirm it? I did not know that. I mean, you know, do you think all but everybody.
They've been wrong before, but.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, do you think maybe Sony really didn't have much faith in the project?
No. No, if you saw it and you played it, you realize that this had the potential to be big. I'm not sure I'm selling a million, but at least move a sizable amount of units for the company.
Well, you know, the flip side of it, too, is you spend the dollars that you have, right? And if you've let's say that you ramp up, because, I mean, this stuff takes 3-4 years to, you know, to come to fruition. And if you spend the money to, you know, put the studio together, to actually go through production and all the, you know, infrastructure and everything to get everything going, if the money isn't there to spend for marketing, then, hey, at least you've got a product and you put out the product that you have because you have it.
Which it definitely feels that is the situation I believe Sony's in right now, because they haven't been pushing their product during the holidays. And just like Sly Cooper, a lot of people on Twitter are saying, even some of the guys at EDR are saying they were surprised, and these are industry analysis, they're surprised that Sly Cooper was coming out this week.
Yeah,
that's never the case. Anyway, on to bigger and better, brighter impressions, things I want to talk about. Deadly Premonition Director's Cut. I saw, speaking of companies that in different shapes and forms, Ignition Entertainment, they were becoming a bit of a contender in the publishing world. I remember I saw Muramasa. I was really excited for that. King of Fighters 12, I was excited when I first saw it. Not so much when I reviewed it. Metal Slug 7, I know that some people don't like that one, but I thought it was a decent enough iteration for the franchise. And before their downfall, when they sent El Shaddai for review a full 3 months after a retail release, poor Sean tackled that one. They published Deadly Premonition for the Xbox 360 over in Japan. Both versions came out, but they only brought the 360 version. Now, that title holds the Guinness record for the most divergent review in a survival horror, in the survival horror genre, which is, they have a lot of records if they're if they're keeping tabs on that. So one reviewer gave the game a perfect score, and I think several critics perhaps gave the goose egg. No, I take that back. Gave 2 out of 10s there. So last week I was invited by Rising Star Software. They were the publishers of Akai Katana and Under Defeat HD, a couple of solid shmups, especially Katana. They invited me to take a look at the PS3 exclusive director's cut of Deadly Premonition. And let me preface this by saying, by talking about my shortcoming. I never played the original 360 version. I was supposed to see an early build, but in hindsight, this was coming at a time when Ignition was kind of starting their downfall. And I believe I reviewed Arc Rise Fantasia, a JRPG, and I really kind of slighted it for the translation and for the gameplay. And I don't know what happened, but perhaps I got disinvited. So, as such,
unfriend.
Yeah, I didn't get too much hands-on time with the game. So when I entered Rising Star's Hollywood office, I was greeted by Axis Games, Swery, that's all caps, no last name, Tomio Kanazawa, the senior producer for the director's cut. Both were very nice, and as I mentioned, they complimented me on my voice. Won me over. And
then, hey, I didn't know. Really, is Swery his thing? Is all lowercase? Is that the way he?
No, all uppercase.
Oh, all uppercase. Yeah, I didn't know that either. I
Swery. Yeah.
No idea. Well, and so what does that mean anyway? I don't even know.
I didn't ask.
That's the first thing you ask.
There's another question I didn't ask, but I'll get to that. Okay. They explained, one of the first things they explained was their aspirations were Western games. Both of them had recently enjoyed playthrough Skyrim. And they were really kind of fell in love with the open-endedness, and that is something that served as kind of an inspiration for Premonition. So with that, we jumped into the games, created a new opening cinematic, which didn't really impress me. A lot of shimmery, repetitive textures and a fairly low frame rate. Kind of a lack of context prohibited me from becoming immersed in this world. It's seen through the eyes of a FBI agent. His name is York. He's this kind of kooky character. Periodically, he places his finger to his temple and has these long, kind of drawn-out conversations with an entity known as Zach. I don't know who that is, whether it's a kind of Fight Club type personality within him. Mm-hmm. So with the developers there, I didn't have the heart, Jeremy, to ask the big question, how much, and this is the question, how much of the weirdness in Deadly Premonition is deliberate, and how much of it is to just cover up the general jankiness of the game? The developers, they skipped to a scene of York. He was shooting this girl who had shapeshifted into this contorted spider-walking monstrosity. You could just tell that the game didn't exactly have a sense of polish. Later, they jumped ahead to this other mission where players had to find a specific key. It was like a squirrel key in a local jail. And then one of the deputies, he had the running animation of a schoolgirl, and I couldn't determine if they're trying to, you know, cast him as effeminate, whether it was supposed to be funny, and the room did break into laughter, or what. And similarly, there was this cutscene of York. He was enjoying this homemade pastry, where he repeatedly comments on how good it is, and the camera kind of lingers for this awkward, if comical, length of time. And I just wanted to know, you know, how much of that is deliberate. Baloo, I think you'd eat it up. I think you'd love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, honestly, I didn't even know that there was a director's cut of Deadly Premonition coming out.
Yeah, I was going to say at the beginning, speaking of games that have weird promotional cycles, like this thing, they announced it a while ago, and then it just, like, fell off the face of the earth. And I'm like, did this come out? Are they still doing it? And I guess here it is.
And one of the things, I don't want to slag on it too much, but I did begin to enjoy its vibe. There was this one conversation during a driving sequence, which was pure Bret Easton Ellis, you know, Patrick Bateman. York was doing this in-depth analysis of the movie Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. And then at the end of this lengthy dissertation, he admits to not even having seen the film. And so it's like,
what?
all these facts about the film, and then he says, yeah, I should really watch it one day. As I mentioned before, I didn't play the original, but several of the media in the room did seem to notice a visual upgrade. At times, there was kind of a nice amount of on-screen detail. There was a jail that flaunted some nice lighting effects, probably bringing the game to, say, 2010 standards. Load times were quick. And interiors were really, they had a lot of detail, even though the outdoor environments were fairly Spartan. Rising Star, they didn't want to comment on an MSRP, but thankfully pretty soon I got home and Amazon disclosed the details. They have the director's cut selling for $39.99. or twice the price of the Xbox 360 version. So when the game releases in April, I'd say pick it up. If you're like Blue and enjoy kind of quirky, offbeat humor and maybe have the ability to overlook blemishes, but if you're just looking for a straight-up, polished action survival horror experience, then you might want to steer clear on this one. So it's really the beauty of it is just kind of in the quirkiness, and it's one of those games where you don't take it too seriously and just have fun with it.
See,
so it's like the EDF of survival horror, right?
Totally.
Yeah. I have heard it said, and this is not new, and I'm definitely not going to take credit for this, but even in your description of this, it sounds a hell of a lot like Twin Peaks.
Yes, at one time the game was very much like Twin Peaks, I had heard, the original game. And they went back and they changed some things.
Well, but even the stuff you're describing, like the stuff about, this is it's like a good cup of coffee. It's like a good pastry. This pastry is really good. How good is this pastry? It's so good. This pastry is really good. Or even like dropping random facts like, Agent Cooper, just like knowing just like weird things. Like, oh, point of interest, you know, da-da-da-da. Just dropping knowledge and stuff. And, just David Lynchian sort of. You know, and the stuff you were saying about is it on purpose or not, that's interesting too, because that stuff, it's hard for you know, some of this stuff to cross cultures even when you're trying to play it straight, you know? And so you got to wonder, like, are they getting totally lucky or are they, you know, I find that really interesting. And just almost in like this art house sort of analysis of like Ed Wood movies or something like that. Like, is this guy a total genius or is he a flippin' idiot? You know, like, is this for real? Like, you don't even know. And I, you know, there's kind of a weird meta appeal to that sort of thing. Like, I can sort of dig that.
The Attack of the Killer Tomatoes reference totally reminded me of the analysis Patrick Bateman would make of Genesis and Whitney Houston and all that stuff. So a little bit of that mixed in.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad it's still coming out. Like I said, I thought for a while that it just sort of got sucked into the void.
Yeah. So my other visit last week was to the University of Southern California, USC campus, for the Glimpse event. They offered an all-day presentation and a demo, which really showed the school's kind of interdisciplinary approach to things. They combined the schools of education, engineering, communications, cinema arts, even Hollywood. You know, they were all working together, creating some really innovative stuff. Now, not all of it's kind of gamey, but I want to talk about a few things. One of the creations that they showed that it really kind of impressed me was this traffic app, which, unlike, you know, Google, their competitors, they combined big data with LA, you know, some of the big data from LA traffic agencies, LA, because, you know, of course, we're obsessed with traffic, as well as real-time crowdsourcing. So anyone who has the app, they give up their, you know, GPS location speed, and all that is combined to create kind of time-saving info and possibly eliminating pollution. So really kind of cool. They also showed they had a communication professor. And Jeremy, you were talking about how it's in the marketing. And he was gathering info from Twitter to measure sentiment in ways which were faster and broader than any kind of pre-existing data collection methods. You know, Nielsen boxes were no longer relevant with this. Two things that he examined: movie openings, and he had this graph, and there were a bunch of little bubbles in there, and each of the bubbles, the size represented how much people were talking about it, and red was a negative sentiment, and green was a positive sentiment, which was really kind of interesting. The other thing he was looking at was the presidential elections, you know, real-time data during presidential debates that you could actually track. So closer to games, they showed off one cool thing was the capturing facility, which is this giant orb filled with controllable lights, and they work to gather facial details under, you know, different lighting conditions. And one of the takeaways was the elimination of what we call, you know, the uncanny valley. They captured this model talking, this female, and then they showed the CG replacement, and I swear every blink, every expression, every smile, every eye movement was perfectly modeled. And so they'd cut away and show like the mesh frame, and you really couldn't tell, you know, which was which. And that to me was amazing. One of the things that they're doing with this is they're preserving narratives from the Holocaust survivors, which I have to admit, you know, gave me chills. The other thing was
it's kind of like what they did in the Superman movie when they had all those people in the crystals and they were like, your home planet. Maybe, was that insensitive? I didn't mean to compare that to the Holocaust, but you know, the whole planet exploded. Anyway, carry
on. Grown. Anyway, USC Game Lab, they took the stage, and I know a lot of schools, they like to throw around the term gamification. But really, USC is doing it.
I love gamification.
Love the idea, but here's a school that's actually doing it. The Game Lab is where Flow, Jeremy, I know you know that one. From
the most violent, cannibalistic game that's ever been released on video games. It's the only game where you, like, consume your own people.
Yeah.
That's I mean, true. All other games, you're attacking others and, you know, enemies and things. But on this, you're like, I'm this worm thing, and I'm going to eat my friends.
So...
That is pretty grisly.
Some of the things that they showed were they showed things that were, you know, kind of leisure-oriented games. They had this one called Scrapyard, which was the student-developed game, which evokes the mechanics of, as we mentioned, PlayStation All-Stars, Battle Royale, and Super Smash Brothers. And then they also had these more serious applications. They had a simulation to help soldiers and Marines with PTSD, and they had another decision-making tool for the military, which kind of tasked players with making leadership decisions. So a lot of really interesting stuff coming out. As far as gamification, the School of Education was working with them to create this, I think it was a Facebook game, where students go and then they kind of simulate filling out their FAFSA, their financial aid forms. And I guess they tracked students that had played the game, and they were much more likely to fill out the real forms quicker than students who had not played the game. So,
oh, that is cool. That is cool. Yeah, we actually have a similar thing here at the University of Utah. Shout out to the Digital Arts and Engineering group here. They do all of that stuff. They've got medical physical therapy games for kids to try and help them to recover from, you know, surgeries and things like that. And they have they actually have the students do sort of like pseudo contract work for small projects and things like that, and kind of get into the process of design. And they've got things that they hook up Kinects and moves and all kinds of stuff. It's kind of neat to go up there and see students working on that stuff, because you know what, if you don't have to worry about your day job, man, I guess you can come up with all kinds of cool things.
Oh, Jeremy. So last, I wanted to give some actual hands-on impression for a change.
Yes.
Nano Assault Neo, which is developed by Shinin Media, and they are the creators of Nanostray and the I always forget the other one.
Nanostray 2.
Iridian franchise.
Oh, yeah.
The DS game. And between their name and their output, because they have those shmups, a couple of years ago, I assumed that they were a Japanese developer, but they turned out to be this German studio that just worships the house of Nintendo. So if you recall my review of Nano Assault for the 3DS, I enjoyed half the game. The twin stick shooting around these strangely shaped objects, that was kind of a nice blend of Geometry Wars and Super Stardust HD. But the game it had these flying levels, which felt like some of the FMV sequences from the old PS1 Star Wars games. They weren't fun. So Nano Assault Neo focuses on the former, relegating the latter to bonus sections. You are, you know, when during the bonus sections, you're not flying through the air anymore. You're confined to the floor, collecting currency tokens while you avoid these obstacles and you gradually speed up. But anyway, back to the shooting, because that's why you purchased the $10 download. That's the game's bread and butter. Enemies show off a nice amount of variety, but they don't quite show up in the quantities like Neo's contemporaries. They can be a little bit more difficult because they phase in around you. And additionally, the strange shapes, they resemble things like blood cells under an electron microscope. The whole game, the motif is looks like you're looking at greatly amplified organisms. The shapes of the levels, they can reduce your firing range as you maneuver around the edges there. The game itself has 4-stage campaigns, and you gradually kind of build up your arsenal. You can collect bonus tokens, which I haven't seen in a while. You spell out the letters bonus, B-O-N-U-S.
Wow.
What's the last game that's done that?
That's pretty old. And do you have to get them in order, and if you miss it for the level, like, that's it? Yeah, nobody does that anymore.
Yeah, so
it kind of sucks. No, no, I'm just kidding. I'm sure it's good.
It's just a
lost heart.
Anyway, first you start off this pea shooter, then you work your way up. You have these options which follow you around, and special weapons that make mincemeat out of your lesser foes. The right trigger will send out this kind of homing weapon for one. Technically, the game's a minor masterpiece, great 60 frame per second delivery. But it strangely, it forces you to choose between your TV screen, your gamepad. Sometimes it replicates the image. But other times the sound coming out doesn't come out through the gamepad. The trance-based soundtrack is a little too twitchy and shrill for my taste, but other than that, $10, it's probably one of the best original downloads for the Wii U's rather barren eShop there. Oh, and the last thing, just a quick mention I've been playing, is the Hitman HD collection. I won't spend too much time. It's pretty much what the title advertises. It's Hitman up-resed, same textures, same poly count, same kind of clunky animations. Agent 47 doesn't run very well. Stole a page out of Deadly Premonition's animation playbook. It looks sharp. At least once I uncovered a bug, when the map screen comes up, it immediately disappears. But other than that, it's a solid port, and considering that the game's now going for around $25, I picked it up at Best Buy on sale. You know, it's worth picking up for fans that haven't played the games, or maybe players who have a little bit of patience, because it's one of those kind of slow burn, tense stealth games, not necessarily an action game in any regards, because you'll be doing a lot of walking and not much running in the games.
So would you say it's better for fans who haven't played the game? Just kidding, that's just what you said, so it didn't make any sense. I just wanted to...
I'm sorry, I haven't played the older games. I stand
oh, right. I see, fans of the new game.
The new one has a different speed. Locations are a lot smaller, so therefore the walking doesn't seem as annoying. But this one, you really, you know...
Walk. You got to walk across the courtyard to that villa, then you got to go up to the party room, then you got to...
Yeah.
God, that mission was a pain in the ass.
That mission, that was the whole Hitman.
Yeah, like all those missions.
I have like a Hitman 2, I want to say, and I never got past the first level in that. And I mean, I like to think I'm pretty decent at stealth games. I mean, I beat the original trilogy of Splinter Cell and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I could just never quite connect with the Hitman game.
Like that and Thief is the other one that I have that problem with.
I love them. I like them both.
I do. I like Thief. But you know what? I spent more time replaying that first mission in Thief 1. And, you know, going the three different ways and stuff like that, and then dying on the second level and going back and doing the first level again and trying it a different way. Man, I played that first level to death.
Yeah.
That's as far as I ever got.
The fiction got really strange at the end.
Yeah, I've heard.
Jeremy, last today.
Well, I have been playing, actually, I want to say, you know, the last show we did, you know, believe it or not, people are accusing me of being a Sony shill. I haven't actually been playing too much. Yeah, I know. Believe it or not, right? I haven't played with really any of my Sony platforms in the past little while. I mean, I've kind of dabbled here and there, but I haven't gotten into anything seriously. So I am doing a Sony-free impressions this time.
Oh.
So I have actually been playing most recently Skulls of the Shogun on Xbox Live Arcade. It is from the studio 17-Bit, and it is a long time coming. It is a turn-based strategy game, sort of in the vein of Advance Wars, or, you know, it's one of those kinds of things where you have a few units that have certain specialties, and, you know, kind of the rock, paper, scissors kind of style, only it is skinned or it is themed with a sort of medieval Japanese afterlife motif.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So it's it's pretty neat. Of course, like most of those games, you know, I think I had mentioned on our previews for that week that you know, they keep making games like this because it's a really great formula. I mean, who doesn't love Advance Wars? It's awesome. I mean, and we even talked about other spin-offs, you know, other knockoffs, Mecha Wars and things like that recently. It's one of those kinds of games, and they do some pretty interesting things with this. Number one, the first thing that you'll notice about Skulls of the Shogun is that it doesn't use a movement grid at all. Everything is simply done in kind of a, when you select a unit, you can of course take actions, but then you have a movement circle, and you can basically move freely within that circle as far as you want. You have a little, you know, meter that kind of shows you, it contracts the circle around you so you can see how much movement you have left. And you can sort of play with it. So like most games that, you know, that are worth their salt, they let you kind of test the water a little bit and kind of see, like, do I actually want to make this move? Do I want to cancel and start over again? Yeah. And so you have a few different kinds of units. You have your infantry, your cavalry, archers, special abilities. But one of the things about this, so all of the characters are undead. And there's kind of a neat story to it also. I believe you play as General Akumoto, I think is his name, who, you know, in the opening cutscene, he is about to claim the shogunate of medieval Japan, and he is unceremoniously stabbed in the back, and he dies and is sent to the afterworld, where he starts to cause some problems and get a little rowdy. Everybody's waiting there for their path to the afterlife, and he decides, you know what, screw this. And he starts recruiting people and basically causing a ruckus, and the whole plot unfolds about who actually killed him and, you know, what's the... know what's going on, but
does the undead forces like invade the living world and have like an epic battle?
No, it's actually you sort of take your band and you are sort of forcing your way into the, you know, I'm not sure what the Japanese equivalent of the Greek Elysian fields would be, but they basically are trying to claim their eternal reward in the afterlife. You know, they basically...
The netherworld, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they go and there's this big line and they're like, oh, you know, the current wait time is 500 years. And he asks the last guy in line, well, how long have you been waiting here? And he says, I've been here about 20 years. And he's like, screw that. So he decides that he's going to, you know, he's not going to stand for that. So he starts recruiting...
Anybody thinking Dragon Ball Z right about now?
Kind of. I know that there's the, what's the room that he goes into? The
hyperbolic time chamber?
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking of, the hyperbolic time chamber. Yeah, man, that show is terrible. Anyway, the...
And I sat through all of it.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind it, except it's such a soap opera. Like, half of each episode is recounting what you saw, you know, the episode before. It's just, anyway. I don't know. So as you kill or dispatch enemy units, they will drop a little skull. And you, for some reason, I'm not really sure where this came from, but he's like, okay, everybody, start eating those skulls. And which it's kind of weird. It's like, okay, well, we're skeletons and we're just going to start eating skulls. And they're like, really? So the writing is kind of cute. You know, the voice acting is sort of the mumbly gibberish, you know, but I swear, and you know, there are little references here and there and it's kind of clever writing, but the General Akimoto, you know, they have little placeholder like, you know, that they do. And he says something that I swear sounds like Boshuda, like from, Star Wars, you know, like Jabba the Hutt says. I don't know if that's on purpose or not, but there's a lot of little things like that. But, anyway, so as your units start consuming skulls, it refreshes their health. And, if you get three skulls, your character turns into a demon and gets a little Oni sort of face mask. And then he can take two moves or he can take two actions per turn. So normally you just move your character once and that's it, just like Advance Wars or just like any of those other games. But if you have that, and he doesn't have to necessarily kill the person. You kill someone and their skull drops and you can start building up, you know, like an archer is really powerful because, anytime you attack someone, there's normally a counterattack. But archers, you know, will have potentially, if they're using their ranged attack on someone who's not ranged, you can basically attack with impunity. And there's sort of a little attack range for that stuff too. Like, if you're attacking somebody who is sort of out, you know, on the outer edges of your range, they might have a chance to dodge or to, you know, that, you know, you miss your attack, you know, something like that. And, so it's kind of nice to have the archers to be able to pick people off. So as you progress through the game, as you progress through the campaign anyway, they do a really good job of just like in Advance Wars. You know, the thing about Advance Wars that it did really well was, you get the basic idea in the first two or three missions, right? But then they're like, okay, well now there's this unit and this unit can do this. Okay, well now there's this unit and this unit actually trumps that unit except when this unit is nearby and then you do this. And it just sort of eases you. I mean, really, you know, when you play Advance Wars, you get in, you know, you're good 20 missions in and you're still learning about new little combinations. And if, you know, if they were to give you all of that stuff to begin with, you know, you're, you know, in Advance Wars, what did they have? They eventually you get
in gasoline. Goddamn gasoline.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, yeah, so there's no real you don't run out of any fuel so far as I've come across in this, but there are – you can capture and haunt either rice paddies or buildings to – you know, it's kind of the equivalent of factories. And it's kind of funny when the guys go to haunts, you know, they start kind of like spazzing out or something and little, you know, ghosty things start coming up out of them. And you can actually move them off of that unit and it will continue to get resources for you. So I think in Advance Wars, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there was money. So you'd have, it was like 300 units for an infantry, for a rocket guy. Same thing here. You gain like 25 rice, you know, per paddy per turn. And then you can spend that on different kinds of units. So you can basically, it's not unlimited, but you can basically start spawning out new units and each of the maps is, you know, potentially there can be two or three parts to it. So you might have, you know, a handful of enemies on one particular screen, you overcome them and then they give you free time, you know, to kind of like move and consume the skulls. You know, anybody can eat the skull that you want to. So you can say, oh, I'm going to level up this particular archer. And then when it's done, you know, then you can move on to the next stage of the mission and, you know, and away you go. And they basically just keep it moving. One of the things that I like about this, you know, and I've kind of had some trouble getting into some strategy games lately. I mean, even, I have to say, even, you know, last year I really liked XCOM, but XCOM still, I found myself kind of getting stuck a little bit in the, you know, where am I going to move this guy? Okay, let me explore all of my possibilities. And I kind of had a tendency to slow myself down a little bit. And I don't know if that had to do more with the, you know, because even XCOM, it didn't really have grids, but it kind of did. You know?
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
You know, they tried to make it a little bit more fluid looking, like it didn't, you were on a grid, but everything was sort of grid based. In this, I don't know if that's it or what, but I feel more inclined to just move through a little more quickly. And I have heard, but I haven't played multiplayer myself, I've heard that you can actually set, little parameters, like you can say, all right, you're going to have 30 seconds to take all of your moves, you know, all five of your moves or whatever. And so you can actually set it up so it, you know, you don't really have time and you just need to start doing stuff. And I found that to be really attractive and it really started, you know, it really motivated me to kind of keep playing through levels and make progress. So it really has that certain something and I don't even know what to really credit it to that kind of drives me. Whereas in other games, I know I would kind of get stuck or kind of get bored or whatever, but you know, between the dialogue, which is really kind of funny and cute and fun to go through and just the mechanics of the game, really pretty neat. 1200 Microsoft points. And it's actually available. Here's kind of a neat thing. I think in the, you know, the release week, write up, I think I did was, the neat thing is that it comes only to Microsoft platforms. So it's, Xbox Live. I'm not sure, you know, to be honest with you, I'm not sure if there must be a Windows 8 version.
There is.
And then there's Windows Mobile. And then I think they're going to be doing, there's something else that I'm forgetting. What is it that I'm missing here?
Surface.
Surface. That's right. Surface. And all of these are cross-compatible. You know what it actually reminds me of is last time I think I talked a little bit about Hero Academy. It's it's a little bit Hero Academy-esque. Hero Academy only goes between PC and iOS and like iPhone, I think, or iPad. But this will cross-play, you know, all of those platforms. It's cloud-based, so you can, you know, if you have those products, you know, you can pick up your Surface and you know, finishing. I don't know. Listen, this is how they wanted to do this. They're promoting it as a, but I don't think, I haven't heard anything about it coming to PC. You know, I kind of have a feeling, I doubt that this is going to go anywhere other than the platforms that it's already on.
Windows 8, yeah. I would have loved to play it on my Android tablet. The one thing I was going to say, Jeremy, was the movement system sounds a lot like, I don't expect you guys to have played this, but Phantom Brave.
You know, when he mentioned the like circle radius for movement, I thought, you know, wasn't that kind of like Phantom Brave? But I only played about like an hour or so of it.
Bless you, Blue. for realizing that. And I liked, you know, Phantom Brave, one of the things you can do is you can absorb or you can move into, you know, tree stumps and things like that. But to be honest, I like Phantom Brave for the characters, but I always like the grid-based movement of Disgaea a little bit more.
Yeah, and I can see that.
Because there was a little bit more, I don't know, certainty. You knew how many squares.
That's kind of what I like about this. You can actually group your guys together. I mean, the uncertainty. I mean, it's not that it's uncertain, but, you know, I mean, that was one of the things about Advance Wars 2 and you know, other games is you get into kind of this gridlock situation.
Yeah.
Okay. And you don't really have that here. In fact, it's kind of neat when you group guys together. So there's also, I mean, there are other mechanics too, like knockback. Like if you, you know, if one of your infantrymen hits someone, you can actually have, like they teach you this in like the second or third mission. They're like, oh, you know, go get this guy. And you can actually knock him right off the edge of the cliff and he's dead and that's it. Or you know, the mission after that or the second mission after that, there's like three cavalry guys up there and they're like, oh my God, those cavalry guys. But you're like, no sweat, you know, Shogun, let me go up and I'll just, you know, kill all three of these and you just knock them right off. If you group guys together, they sort of get this sticky, they'll kind of stick a little bit. They'll kind of clump together and form, I think they call it like a spirit wall, but it's basically like, you know, you're going to form a line of your guys. And if anybody is attached to a spirit wall, you don't get the knockback and you actually get a defensive bonus. You know, and there are other, you know, they also do things that are really smart. Like they'll actually do, if you fire, arrows from behind a spirit wall, you know, other archers, you know, normally would have an opportunity to return fire. But if you're behind a spirit wall, like they sort of figure out like, oh, you know, you're in the spirit wall. So I guess they can't return fire. But still somebody can totally go around you if they want to. And it's kind of fun too. At the end of your turn, you know, like I said, you have sort of this shrinking circle of movement. And if you take your action and then you still want to move, you know, you might be able, like I've had a few times where like, okay, I really want this guy to be behind these infantry people. And I'll kind of wiggle him around and they kind of bubble around him a little bit. Like you can kind of almost like I can't even think of what it's like, but if, you know, on touch screens or something, if you move your finger over stuff and the stuff kind of moves out of the way or whatever, you know, you can kind of crunch guys in there and like crowd them in and be like, okay, now you're safe. And I can see what you're saying about the grid base, but I just like the idea of having something that's a little bit more dynamic. So you can never absolutely be sure what's going to happen. And it goes both ways. Sometimes you can kind of wiggle your way in or kind of, you know, strike at something that maybe the other guy thought like, oh, I'm totally safe here. But hey, actually you're not. And like I said, to me, that kind of keeps the game going rather than necessarily locking it down and getting you stuck in like trench warfare. Just different ways of looking at it.
Hmm. How long do games usually take in that?
It'll time you, and actually there you get little scores based on how long it takes, but, you know, maybe 15, 20 minutes. You know, obviously it depends on the mission, of course, you know, you can get through them, you know, pretty quickly. So, you know, you don't have to worry too much about, you know, saving in the middle or something like that. You can have a pretty good experience just with a single sit down. But, it's just a little different, you know, and you're right. I mean, there are other ways. I mean, I was thinking, Valkyria Chronicles also in terms of, you know, free range, they would give you just a basically movement meter. And as long as you could spend it, you know, you do a lot of weird stuff. That was the thing that really kind of attracted me was just sort of the fluid. So, I mean, you can definitely see it working on a touch interface. Obviously, I played it with an Xbox controller, but, you know, being able to move things around and kind of bubble them in there with your finger and like, oh, I'm going to squish you guys together and that sort of thing. I could see that actually working really well in some of those other platforms as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, Skulls of the Shogun.
Does it have any sort of like a pickup, like skirmish mode or whatever that some strategy games have?
Yeah, it does. Like I said, I've mostly been working through the campaign. Cause to me, the other thing too, I kind of like the campaign and the fact that it walks you through stuff. But on the other hand, one of the things and I don't want to say this is a negative. I always hate when we take something that's good and say, oh, well, it's bad because it's not doing the opposite thing. But on one hand, it does have really neat tutorials and it takes you through stuff. On the other hand, though, it's kind of like, well, here's a level where we teach you how to do this, and here's a level where we teach you how to do this. And there's one way to beat this level, and it's use this new mechanic that we're going to teach you. And I don't want to fault it for that. I absolutely do not want to fault it for that. However, it seems to me, not having played multiplayer, that the really cool part of this would come out if you're actually playing against someone else and you have your full range of tools, and anything can happen. I mean, like I said, in the campaign, the levels are really set up to be like, oh, You know, you're going to have these particular units. They start you out every mission. You have sort of a unique set of units, and they might arrange you in a certain way. But, you know, when it comes to things like skirmish modes and multiplayer modes, to me, I feel like that might be even a better way to play it once you sort of get out of the, like, here's the level where we teach you this thing, and that's the only way to win and that. But like I said, generally speaking overall, you know, a lot of neat stuff happens in Skulls of the Shogun. It's, like I said, just really well produced. You can tell they really wanted to do it right. And of course, there's going to be a demo of it. Everything has a demo on Xbox, which is one of the really nice things about Xbox Live. So mm-hmm. Go check it out. Try it out. See if you like it. I think you'll get a pretty good idea of what you're in for, especially if you like those kinds of games, the Advance Wars and what have you. I think this is definitely worth taking a look at.
So. Jeremy.
Yes, sir.
Are you going to pick up Fire Emblem?
Probably not. You know, in fact, that's the thing. So I've never played a Fire Emblem game. No, you know what? I reject your scorn. And you listening to this show, I reject your scorn. I reject
it. They're good.
I'm sure they are good. So here's the thing. I've never played a Fire Emblem game, and I would sort of like to know, and I'm sure, you know, you guys are going to have a chance to try it out and tell us all about it, but I would sort of like to know, why now should I pick up a Fire Emblem game and be interested in it? Just a legitimate question, just throwing it out there for people, because I have no excitement about this particular franchise. I know people really love it. I know it's got the whole difficult permadeath sort of thing, and I can kind of dig that.
Optional.
Yeah, right, which is optional, and you can decide if you like it or not. But there are a lot of strategy games out there. I still haven't put as much time into, like, War of the Lions or, you know, Ogre Tactics or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there I could be choosing from. So your homework and your homework, listener, is to get into the show comments and tell me why I should be excited about Fire Emblem on the 3DS.
Well, how's your 3DS backlog?
It's getting there. I have a lot of stuff that I haven't even opened yet. I haven't opened my copy of Paper Mario that I got for Christmas. I love Paper Mario. I know.
I did not enjoy that too much. I put about 6 hours in and I put it down.
Well, really? So let's explore this for just a minute. Let's talk about this. So first of all, let me ask, what is your history with Paper Mario? Are you a Paper Mario fan?
I'm not crazy about the series, but I do like them. And for this, I will tell you flat out, I am a traditionalist. I expected more traditional role-playing.
And what does that mean to you?
Maybe more Super Mario RPG, less Paper Mario 64.
More numbers? More what? What does it mean?
More being able to power up your main character instead of just continuing. They tried to throw out a lot of role-playing tenets, and that's admirable. But subjectively, I don't like that.
Okay, well, that's fine. I mean, because that's what the game is.
And that's great. That's great that they threw things out, but I'm just not having a good time with it. Okay. It's just collecting the stickers, grabbing those. It just got a little tiresome. Yeah. The combat's cool, and I won't knock that. I think the it's always been turn-based, but with the button presses, I was
little events, and they're really different and neat, too. So let me ask you, have you ever played any of the Mario and Luigi series?
Yeah.
And what do you think of that?
I dug it. What was the one on DS? Bowser's?
Inside Story. Well, there.
Yeah, Bowser's.
There was also Partners in Time.
Yeah, Partners in Time came before it, but Bowser's Inside Story was the newest one.
I think Bowser's Inside Story is. I really enjoyed the writing. It was just a really fun.
Yes, it just occurred to me just like this past week to ask on Twitter, what do you prefer, Paper Mario series or Mario and Luigi series? And I kind of feel like I'd have to give the edge a little bit to Mario and Luigi. Superstar Saga on the GBA was awesome. Some awesome writing, really great localization. I don't often like literally laugh at games, but I have in the Mario and Luigi series. I really like Paper Mario too, though. I haven't played Sticker Star. I don't have those same kinds of compunctions about things being streamed down or simplified. Mm-hmm. But I just haven't gotten to it. In fact, one of the things on my list here is for the 3DS. We'll get to that in just a minute. But that's something that's kind of been a long time coming. I've got a backlog.
Did Intelligent Systems make Paper Mario?
I don't know who made Paper Mario the first.
This last one, the Sticker Star.
Oh, I don't know. I could go get my case and look at it. But the name sounds familiar. That sounds right. I know that it was Alpha.
Because they made this other great game called Fire Emblem, which you need to play during. like that.
Is this all a setup? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it is.
I see. I'm not against playing Fire Emblem. I'm just saying I am not chomping at the bit as much as I see everybody else chomping at the bit for this game.
this one, well, I won't get into it, but
we'll have a chance to talk about it after.
I really liked Fire Emblem.
Really?
Yeah.
One of my favorite
games of the year.
A lot of good series out there, and I try and eliminate those blind spots in my video game fluency whenever I can. So Fire Emblem is definitely on the, not the short list, but it's on the list somewhere to eventually play, but it's not like I'm like, yeah, Fire Emblem, I gotta play it. So maybe one day. I'll live vicariously through the rest of the internet, though, because I know that, in fact, it's already scarce, I guess, right? It's hard to come by, I guess. If you
want. Well,
actually, it was some sort of a distribution problem, wasn't it? Mm, okay. Apparently some stores are going to be getting it on Friday, I want to say,
yeah.
But the download version is out now.
Yeah, after I posted the review, I talked to Nintendo, and they sent me a kind of PR spiel, and the closing line was, of course, you can always download it now.
Of course.
But, you know, there's that option. They gave me a download code, and it didn't take very long at all to download, and within a few hours, I was totally hooked.
Oh, how about that?
So, yeah, great characters, great writing, great voice acting. Some of the best voice to come out of the DS. And great, phenomenal music. And, you know, characters that I cared about.
You know what that sounds like? That sounds like something that Blue and I were talking about before the show. Hit Icarus Uprising. Yeah. Which I actually have had it on the list a few times to talk about on the show, but I haven't. I'm not going to talk about it now, but... one of the strengths of that game. I mean, it made a pretty decent argument, I feel, for like a game of the year 2012, Kid Icarus.
Sure.
So
yeah,
I can totally get on board with...
I'm on board.
Yeah, yeah. It was my game of the year last year.
What was that, fifth level where you got the platforming? That was no fun for me.
Yeah. Like the jumping and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, if you jumped, if they had kept it on a single plane on the ground, that would have been great. But
yeah, but it's sort of like Zelda, though, where like if you come up to an edge, if it's meant to be jumped off, you can jump off it.
Mm, yeah.
Some people get really like, I call it gamer claustrophobia, like if there's no jump button. Like, oh my god, I gotta jump, I gotta get airborne, I gotta get three dimensions. But, you know, same problem people had with old Bionic Commando.
Yeah.
Eventually they added the jump button, I don't think anybody cared.
One of the first things you buy in Ni No Kuni is a jump.
Really?
Yeah. It doesn't do anything, though.
See, that's awesome. I dig that. It's almost like a
middle... I mean, it's just cosmetic. You can jump around and it's fun. That's it.
Yeah, kind of relaxes that claustrophobia a little bit.
Yep.
So another game that I've been playing that has no jump button is digitally distributed, and you could maybe say that it, you know, has some pretty good voice acting. Boy, that sounded really awesome. Was Dungeon Land on the PC, Dungeon Land, which was just released last week on PC platform. I think it may only be on Steam at this point. I think you might be able to buy it directly. Published by Paradox, Interactive, which I don't know. Is it just me? But they've been really busy over the last couple of years. I mean, it seems like they've really been. Paradox, you guys will remember the logo. It's that like weird fossil thing with like the chin or whatever it is. I don't even know what that's supposed to be. What is that little trilobite thing in there? So Dungeon Land is, you know, we hear a lot about the roguelike game, right? Which is a throwback to the old Rogue, which was actually the title of a game that had its particular mechanics. We don't hear a lot about the Gauntlet-like, and I firmly believe there should be a genre, Gauntlet-like. Was there anything before Gauntlet, something predating Gauntlet? No?
Adventure.
Yeah, it's not really the same thing. So Gauntlet-like. So I'm gonna coin the term right now. Gauntlet. Dungeon Land is the first Gauntlet-like that I can think of recently. And what I mean by Gauntlet-like, so...
What about the interview we had with Rebel Entertainment? They created a Gauntlet-like for Facebook and online.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well...
Edit!
No, here's the thing. It is not the kind of game that gets made very often. I mean, even that. What was that? How long ago was that interview?
Two shows ago?
Yeah, exactly. Like, just within the last couple months.
3 weeks. You're right.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, obviously, like, if that's, you know, if that's the first time we've heard of it since Gauntlet. Anyway, so let's talk about Dungeon Land. So Dungeon Land is a Gauntlet-like, which is playable by up to three people plus a fourth. We'll talk about the fourth in just a minute. And the premise of this game is that... the evil dungeon master has created a kind of a theme park for adventurers, and there are different little worlds or different little lands, kind of like Disneyland. It's split out into different zones, and you join up with two or three other people, and you have three specific classes. You have the warrior, of course, the rogue, and I bet you can guess the third one.
Wizard.
The wizard, the mage. And, yes. So every character, so these are set characters, just like in Gauntlet, where you have, your four characters. And, each one has special abilities. Although they do let you eventually, as you play through the game, part of the goal is to unlock chests and to destroy the environment and collect coins that you can then use to, gain different abilities. You don't gain more abilities, you just gain different abilities as the players. So you have, potions that you can use to heal you, for example, I tended to play as the mage, so you have a fire spell, for example, and the fire spell will send out a sort of a wall of fire that the enemy creeps or whatever, they can't get. Mm-hmm. So as you go through these levels, the thing that makes it really a Gauntlet-like is the fact that there are generators, enemy generators, just like in Gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing. So I didn't play Rebels game, but there you have it. Did they have generators in their game?
Yeah, they did.
Okay, so they did. So
like a pile of bones.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in this case, yeah. they're kind of themed for for the different levels that you are that you're playing, and so the different characters will complement each other in different ways, and obviously the wizard will have fighty kinds of abilities, area of effect kinds of things. The rogue has a cool thing where he will be able to backstab people and do, massive damage, on, larger and smaller enemies. And, of course, the magic user, the mage, is, kind of a, support class character. So he will basically set up scenarios that will, group enemies together, or, there's, for example, you can have an ice loadout that, we'll freeze the bad guys and allow everybody else to kind of take their shots. The neat thing about Dungeonland, one of the neat things about it is that the fourth player that I mentioned actually has a, you can actually have a dungeon master sort of controlling where the generators and what kinds of spells will be cast against the players and kind of making it, a little more interesting anyway. There is AI, so obviously if you're playing without, you can actually play this solo if you want, but the characters that you're playing against, it's going to be sort of just going through a standard level, and the players that you're playing with, they just sort of follow you and kind of do their thing. In that regard, it's generally a little bit light on content, but having played this with a full crew of people, it is kind of neat because sort of in the same way that, let's say in, Left 4 Dead, for example, mm-hmm. there's the AI director, and part of the thing that it'll do, especially in Left 4 Dead 2, was they have specialized characters that they will use to try and separate the characters. So, in Left 4 Dead 2, you would have like the spitter, for example, who would vomit and try and, separate the characters and that sort of thing. And that's the same kind of thing that the dungeon master can do in Dungeonland as well. I mean, you can actually directly cast spells against the players, push them away, do kind of a Jedi Force push and throw someone across the level. Mm-hmm. You can, invoke, rock walls to kind of split people up. You can summon enemies right on top of people. And, so as you're going through this, you basically are trying to, use your standard MMO style tactics, who's our tank, who's our glass cannon, mm-hmm. who's going to be supporting and basically make your way through the dungeons. The thing about it is, it reminds me, and Paradox is just the publisher, but as I started playing Dungeonland, it sort of brought to mind another game of theirs from a couple years ago that, this is a brand new game that's just launched, so of course I want to give it its, little bit of understanding, but it's a little bit laggy, a little bit buggy. It actually reminded me of the first few weeks of Magicka. You guys remember playing mm-hmm. Magicka?
Oh, yeah.
See?
Yeah. I tapped out my keyboard combos.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which Magic is a great game. I'm not talking about right. Magicka, but everybody go check out Magic. You can get it for way cheap. It was super funny, a lot of content, really interesting ideas. Yep. But this kind of, there's a lot of warping that I saw that kind of happens. It's sometimes a little bit hard to tell when your shots are hitting.
Is it 2D or 3D?
It's I mean, the playing field is 2D, but it's, you know, isometric, so there's a 3D-ishness to it. But you're actually playing just in a, you know, confined sort of area, you know, like a gauntlet game or something.
Gotcha.
The other thing about this too, and I didn't try this, but you can always kind of tell when a game was sort of intended for console. I am not sure yet whether Dungeonland is going to come out on Xbox or if it comes out on anything, it would come out on an Xbox. Because in the interface, they actually have, you know, right bumper, left bumper. It's one of those games that's actually designed to be played with a controller. And actually, some of the tips that pop up, the loading tips, like Dungeonland actually works better on a controller. Well, okay, awesome. You know, thanks for putting it on PC. It doesn't work bad. You basically can use WASD to get around, and then you have a couple of, you know, Q and E kind of do different things, you know, firing off your special spells or you know, healing potions or things like that. But I kind of would like to go back and try it with a controller because apparently it's better with a controller. So there is that. If that bugs you, it only bugs me a little bit. You know, as somebody who's played a lot on PC, it just kind of bugs you when you're playing on a keyboard and it's like, oh, hit right bumper. Like, no, you go to hell. but it was a good experience. So like I said, you know, playing by yourself, you know, it's kind of a little bit short on content. But it is a lot of fun. Like most experiences playing with more people, especially if you have a dungeon master and especially if you're all friends and know each other, you know, no hard feelings or anything, but it is quite a lot of fun. So. $10, $9.99, at least on Steam. I'm not sure if it's available on other platforms. Like I said, you might be able to get it directly from Paradox, but yep. So Dungeonland on PC.
A gauntlet-like. Jeremy, I wrote down some names of gauntlet-likes.
Thank
you. You replaced Sacred 2?
No, but I think I have a copy of it.
360, no. Yeah. How about Dungeon Siege?
Now hold on here. If you're calling Dungeon Siege a gauntlet-like, I think we need to really go back and clearly...
Diablo gauntlet-like.
I could see that. The thing about that is it didn't really regenerate, you know? I mean, once you killed those things, they were pretty much gone. I mean, there is a difference between a dungeon crawler and, you know, when I invented the term right here on this podcast, gauntlet-like, I think I had some other more specific things in mind. But shut up. All right, so very last, let me just hit a couple quick things. So like I said, no Sony platforms, but I did play a little bit of Theater Rhythm Final Fantasy on the 3DS. It's been another one of those that's on my backlog, a little bit older, so I won't spend too much time on it. But I just want to mention Theater Rhythm because I really kind of like the way Square Enix has – they've done this a couple times, but I like the way that they are sort of – treating Final Fantasy as a property, which you don't see much outside of things like Disney. What I mean by that, so before Robert like redefines what I'm talking about here, Blue, you played Dissidia, right? Duodecimine. Yeah. You and I both played that, and
which that's going to be on sale starting tomorrow for $10.
Which can I ask a question here? If they say on the logo Final Fantasy 25th anniversary since 1987, wouldn't that put it 2012? Wasn't that last year?
Well, depends on when the year was released.
But the anniversary lasts a whole year, Jeremy.
I see. Okay.
I'm
going to say that to my wife the next time I forget the specific date. I'll be like, no, but honey, it's our anniversary year. it's our 10th anniversary year. It lasts all year long. I'm going to keep that one. I'm going to use that. And, you know, the same thing for PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale. You know, taking the property of, you know, the Sony catalog of people, or taking the Final Fantasy pantheon, all the characters that you know, and putting them into something together and just being very self-aware about it. They did it a lot with Dissidia, and I really like Dissidia. I think they did a lot of cool things. It, you know, even the menu, the characters giving you help in the different, you know, it's like, here's I can't even...
I was trying to think of one from Final Fantasy VIII.
Who's the octopus dude who's in everything? What's his name?
Octopus dude?
Yeah.
No, is that his name?
Typhon and there's the other one, and they're always sort of like goofy together. Typhon and someone. Someone will know the name. But anyway, like the octopus dude, he'll like say a certain thing and it'll be like
Ultros?
Yes, Ultros. Yes, Ultros the octopus guy. Or, you know, like, oh, here's Balthier and he's going to say something. Oh, but here's Fran and she's going to point out how he's kind of a misogynist or something, you know. Not a misogynist, a chauvinist is what I meant to say, but maybe he's a misogynist. He only likes bunny women. And I kind of like that. Like, they've actually done a really good job with that. And Theater Rhythm, which is the game I'm actually talking about here, did it really well, too. They kind of take, you know, little paper cutouts of all of the main protagonists. And the game is totally about the music. And what's the one thing that no matter what you think about a given Final Fantasy game, what's the one thing that everybody agrees on about Final Fantasy? They love the music, right? So they've taken with them the one thing that everybody can love, regardless of what you think about individual titles, and they have made an expansive game. So in terms of what the game is, it's a music rhythm game, sort of like your, you know, any other music rhythm game. It's a little bit like Elite Beat Agents or a Wendon kind of light. There aren't as many different mechanics as you use. It's mostly tapping and a little bit of swiping and kind of some holding and sort of, you know.
It's like a first date.
Yeah, tapping and holding, stroking up and down, you know, holding it and then moving up and down as you, you know, as the pattern changes.
Check it all about.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like a first date in the Hokey Pokey. But they do a lot of unlocks, you know, as you progress through different types of stages. So they have field stages, battle stages, boss stages. They let you choose from just all kinds of music from the entire series. I mean, there's stuff in there that I've never even heard of before. And it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. I can kind of appreciate it on a musical standpoint. And then you unlock new abilities. You unlock new equipment that helps your little guy. So as you play the music stages, you sort of watch your little chosen character sort of traverse, you know, a little area or fight a particular boss. And the idea is how much can you do in the given time span of the, you know, the music track that's playing. And they do a lot of neat things with Street Pass. I actually started playing this with my little 3DS group that meets up once a month. And they were just passing all kinds of Street Pass stuff. I mean, I couldn't even keep track of it all. But the neat thing about it is that you can care about that if you want to, or you can just say, you know what, I really like the music. I'm going to put in some headphones and play through it. It's just really well done. And like I said, I really like the way that they have taken Final Fantasy as a property and just like mushed it all together and just given you the best things that you really like about it, thrown in a lot of fan service, characters that you like, done it in kind of a cutesy way. And I just want to say I really like they let you customize your little player profile a little different ways. And they have this little Mad Lib thing, the stupid Mad Lib that, you know, all your characters, they like say something stupid. And I find that really fun. I for great justice and I'm an idiot or something like that. You know, they just say little things and it's just kind of cute. So
can I give a shout out to the UI? I think it's absolutely fantastic. It just looks good. It's functional.
Yeah,
it's clean. It's fast. It's responsive.
Absolutely. It's really good. In fact, one of the things I don't know if many people know this, but this game was released originally on 3DS, but it's actually also available on iOS on the iPhone. And the main complaint that I've heard about the iPhone version is that it is not as responsive. There's just something in the operating system or something in the processing or running it in the, you know, with all your other stuff on the phone, that just kind of, it just doesn't quite feel right is what I've heard. Also, one thing about this that is kind of unique, getting less unique though, I guess as time goes on, is it does allow for DLC. You can actually buy add-on. Well, in fact, I don't even know what all the add-ons are that you can buy. I think you can buy
music. Additional music tracks.
Yeah, just music tracks. And
have you bought any, Jeremy?
No, I haven't. In fact, the thing is, there's so much content in this game. Yeah. You can just keep playing it. And, you know, obviously there's a finite amount of music and that, but you're always, I gotta be honest, I don't even know all the stuff I'm unlocking. They have this whole thing of dark notes that are actually not notes. They're actually like suites of music. You've got your standard XP, you've got your crystals, the different colors of crystals that you unlock. You're just unlocking stuff all the time. And I gotta be honest, I couldn't really keep up with all of it, but I think it speaks to the fact that if you are interested in really, you know, going through the game and experiencing everything that they have for you, you're not going to run out of stuff to do. And I think, to me, the great thing about DLC, I mean, I know that some people look at it and say, well, I guess I'm not getting the full game. Well, you know what? Yeah, exactly. So Blue is definitely in that camp. But I feel like, you know what? In this day and age where so few people are finishing games as it is, Why not, for those people who really want more, why not give them more? I mean, maybe it's stuff that wouldn't have been there to begin with. I don't know. And there's a whole debate about that. Is it on disc? Is it not on disc? You know what? Screw it. Who cares? If you want it, you can buy it. If you don't want it, don't worry about it. But I've heard that the iOS version is a little more nitpicky than that. This game right now, Theater Rhythm, if you buy it on the 3DS, I think the MSRP is probably $30 on this. It'll go on sale from time to time. I think I got it for $20 at Christmas.
Yeah, same here. And I've seen it recently about that price as well.
Yeah, I think on iOS, you know, I shouldn't even say because I don't know exactly the price, but I believe it's less money on iOS, although there's probably the Square Enix iOS tax. I believe that they have, I think somebody, you know, you see it sometimes like, oh, somebody on NeoGAF added it all up. It's $140 for the whole game. Okay, well, you know, whatever. I get, you know, you can't change people's minds about that stuff. But that I thought was kind of neat is that the fact that you can actually start expanding. I mean, Nintendo started to get into this a little bit. I think didn't the new Wii U Super Mario Brothers, wasn't there, like, couldn't you buy DLC for that, add-on levels or something like that? Expandability to me is kind of a neat idea. I mean, if you want it, there it is. You know, I think that for as many times as we have, you know, decided to gripe about, like, oh, this is DLC, it should have been included in the main game, I think that we've all found something somewhere that we really wanted, and we'll shell out for it and buy it if we want it, and I think that's our prerogative. And I guess I don't want to rant about DLC, but the last thing that I'll just really quickly talk about, another rhythm game, Rhythm Heaven Fever on the Wii, which I think I got at like a Best Buy sale a while ago. Really difficult to come by, so I don't know that anybody will necessarily come across this, but I wanted to make a mention of it because I feel like people should maybe go look for it, perhaps. One of the interesting things about Rhythm Heaven Fever, not really related to anything in particular, but I noticed that it was the runner-up Wii Game of the Year in, like, at Gamer Magazine, Best Buy's magazine. Yeah.
What?
It actually edged out the last story. No, it edged out the last story.
Payola.
Yeah. Now, I don't know, though. So Rhythm Heaven. Let's talk about Rhythm Heaven for just a minute. So Rhythm Heaven, super simple, super simple game. If you ever played it, so Rhythm Heaven was originally on Rhythm Tengoku, I think, on the Game Boy Advance, Rhythm Heaven on the DS, and now Rhythm Heaven Fever on the Wii. And a very simple premise. It's a little bit, we've talked about in the past, mini games and WarioWare micro games and those kinds of things. This is a little bit like that. They give you, again, it's kind of, I've sort of bundled it here with Theater Rhythm because it's again, they give you a music track and they give you two or three, maybe four little simple patterns, simple rhythm patterns. And they'll give you a little tutorial at the beginning of every one. And the, you know, every song has a weird little
animation?
Yeah, like a little story or something that's going. Oh, okay. You know, I mean, not a story, but yeah, I guess an animation is a fair way to put it. Like for example, the very first thing.
The first date.
Yes. So where he's kicking the football and like weird stuff is happening. Yeah. So I'm trying. That's a good one. Or like the first one that you play in Rhythm Heaven Fever is like you're a golfer who is hitting golf balls out onto a little green that's on an island that's out in the middle of the ocean, and you're being thrown your golf balls by like a lemur or like a little monkey and like a baboon or something. And the little monkey will squeak and throw the ball right to you, and the baboon will be like, ooh, and he'll like have a little warm-up. So they teach you the tutorial through this, and they're like, okay, you know, I'm going to, whenever you hear me, you can watch me, and you can hear me do it this way. And then you hit the button. And then, oh, the gorilla, and they like have a whole little thing, like the gorilla just pegs you with the ball. And they're like, no, you actually have to give some kind of tell, or you have to like show them you're going to do it. So the little monkey has one thing, the big baboon has another thing, and then they let you go. And they're, you know, so you'll... It's not really right for me to describe this, and I would really like to, in fact, if we can find something, I'd like to get like a YouTube video of one. And there's a lot of weird ones too, like there's one where you're like this Lucha Libre fighter, and you know, it's like you're this girl interview. I don't know in that one if you're the Lucha Libre or if you're the girl. I mean, just stuff happens. Like she's like interviewing this guy and she's like, Zimma Zimma Zimma, is that right?
Yeah.
And you know, you have to hit the button to, I guess technically you're the Lucha Libre because you have to like be like, yeah. And then like pose for the fans. And then there's this whole other thing you do. And then all the photographers come up and there's the flash bulbs and things. You have to see this thing. And if it's not the kind of thing that gets a lot of, promotion. I mean, you hear people talk about it, like, oh, Rhythm Heaven. Like, people who like it are really into it. And I just around the house sometimes. I mean, like, I showed my wife the Rhythm Heaven on the DS, and sometimes we'll still sing the little, like, you know, idol song or whatever you call it, the little girl group where they sing about, you know, about love or something. Like, oh, I suppose. Yeah, you know, and they do, like, clap, 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 clap. And everyone is so catchy, it makes me feel like anybody, any game should be able to have catchy music, because every little thing, and they've constructed it just so. The neat thing about this is that after you've played a few of these levels, they do this remix, and they, like, it's just so clever. They just put them all together, and you find out that all of the stuff that you've been doing can be tied together in, like, this weird rhythmic, like, remix way. And it's just fun. There are only two buttons that you use in this, so there's no waggling in this game. But by the same token, I guess it's the type of game that you could theoretically play on just about any platform, because if you've got two buttons, you can play this. So they use the A button and the trigger B button, and it's just a matter of, you know, sometimes you might do one or the other or both. But like on the DS version, you know, there was tapping and flicking. So it's just really simple, but the key is, you know, you're going to find out whether, you know, if you're the kind of person who knows, if you're like, remember that scene in The Jerk where, like, he's with his family? And, like, and if you're Steve Martin from The Jerk and, you know, you're just clapping out of tune, this may not be the thing for you. But let's.
That's me.
Yeah. So I could see, like, I could see if Robert or somebody, if Deagle gets started on this and is like, you know, fuck this. Like, you know, this sucks. You
it's
know.
Like third level where I'm screwing it the little guys.
Yeah. The original, original for the U.S., the Rhythm Heaven on the DS, yep. I could not get into that game. And I loved Elite Beat Agents, but it was just too damn difficult for me. It was too hard to get the timing down. Yeah, and from what I played of Rhythm Heaven Fever, it seems like it's a little bit easier, but I'm still having some trouble with it.
Yeah,
every now and then.
I mean, you kind of have to be the sort of person. I mean, here's the thing: it's cheap now. I don't know if I'd have really spent, you know, $50 and really been pleased with Rhythm Heaven Fever.
You can get a Target on clearance online, $10.
If you can find it, I mean, is it available?
No, online.
Okay,
order.
So if you can get it. So here's what we'll do, Robert. Humor me. Let's put a video for Rhythm Heaven Fever, you know, either a mix, one of the mashups or just an individual level. Let's put it in the notes so people can see it. And you can, get the Lucha Libre one, because, I mean, if that doesn't convince you one way or the other that it's the kind of game you want to play, I don't know what will. But Rhythm Heaven Fever, again, I kind of felt like I'd been playing it on a Nintendo platform. It's a rhythm game, you know, kind of like Theater Rhythm, so I just wanted to kind of talk about both of those. And, you know, like I said, Rhythm Heaven Fever is not the kind of thing you hear about a lot, so I figured I'd be the one to talk about it.
Okay.
And that's it. I'm out.
How far did you get, Jeremy?
I got through probably the third set of stages, I think.
Okay.
So
did you ever get stuck?
Yeah, but, you know, you can go back and try and do better. The thing is that it's not impossible. I mean, it's kind of like,
The Jerk, it is.
Yeah, if you're the jerk. I mean, if you can figure out, like, what the difference is, if you can get anything off of just a normal beat, I mean, you know, it's one thing to have just a beat, 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 but sometimes it's another thing to do a do, 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 and if you can pick up the difference, yeah, I don't know. If you can pick up the difference between that, you can play this game, but... like I said, it is
an interactive podcast. People are clapping along with
maybe,
you. Right?
Maybe you can do it. Somebody clap out a rhythm for me. I'll see if I can pick it out. But yeah,
and somebody gets beaten up and mugged on the subway.
Yeah, it could be.
Clapping along to the podcast.
Start clapping and, you know, clap like the jerk. But anyhow.
Okay, Blue.
Hey, that's me. Wait a minute, I already said that once.
Too much Mario talk.
It's me.
Sound like him.
Well, I as some of you may remember from a couple of episodes ago, probably the one where we were talking about tentacles. With the yes, tentacles and what was that interview that we mentioned during the roguelike talk and the gauntlet-like talk?
Yeah,
that one. Whatever studio that was, that we interviewed or whatever.
Rebel Entertainment.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's the one. I was talking about picking up Blaze Blue Continuum Shift Extend during the Black Friday sale. I got it on the 360. And after I got the PS Vita, you know, back at Christmas, it's actually one of the first games that I double dipped on because, you know, I loved Continuum Shift Extend on the console. And, you know, I love having, you know, fighters on the go. I'm really looking forward to Dead or Alive 5 Plus. Hopefully that it turns out decent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, you know, loved Extend, so it was a no-brainer to pick it up again on the Vita. And I think it's like $20 used and $30 new. And it's actually becoming kind of hard to find. It seems like GameStop's only have like one copy new, one copy used, or
and both open.
Yeah. Well, literally, right. that was the way it was with me. It's like every GameStop, you know, within like 100 miles or 50 miles had low stock listed on their website. And if it has, if it's listed as being low stock on the website, it is pretty much guaranteed to be a gut. What I've picked up on CAG.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bit the bullet. I got it used for $20. And I got to say, you know, I've played every PS Vita fighter, you know, with the exception of, you know, I've played every traditional PlayStation Vita fighter with the exception of PlayStation All-Stars. And I think this is probably the best of the bunch. You know, I know Ultimate Marvel versus Capcom did a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was really good. But, you know, it didn't have a lot in the way of single-player modes. It had the downloadable Heroes and Heralds mode. But that was pretty much it, besides going through the arcade mode and, you know, the command missions and stuff like that. And, I mean, this with Continuum Shift Extend on the Vita, it is practically console perfect. And that's something that you really can't say about the other fighting games on the Vita. You know, Mortal Kombat looks like crap. some of the backgrounds in Street Fighter Cross Tekken changed. I mean, now granted, they did add some extra content to it and made it a decent purchase, at least on the portable. But with BlazBlue Continuum Shift Extend, I mean, it's like there isn't a lot that I've noticed. I mean, I'll have to do like a side-by-side comparison, but you know, maybe like some of the fog elements maybe don't look quite as good on the home console, but aside from that, it is absolutely perfect. It is the exact same game. Of course, they did add some touchscreen controls, but you know, I mean, I've been playing it just as much on the Vita as I have on the home console. It's like I've been dedicating the Xbox 360 version to going through the story mode, whereas with the Vita version, I've been chipping away at the abyss mode where you're digging down, trying to reach the pit of the very last level of the abyss by beating up people and descending depths and picking up power-ups, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I gotta be honest, I'm really hoping that there is some sort of an announcement of the new BlazBlue, Chrono Phantasma, I think it is, coming to the Vita, because I know it's announced as a PlayStation 3 exclusive in Japan. I haven't heard anything about US release yet. There hasn't even been a release date on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a question here. So I have not played BlazBlue. I don't know BlazBlue. What is it? I mean, what makes this game different from fighting game brand X?
Have you played any Arc System Works fighters?
No,
like the Guilty Gear games.
Uh-huh.
Actually, speaking of Guilty Gear, it's rumored that the Guilty Gear whatever the newest version of Guilty Gear is actually going to be coming to the US as well for the Vita.
So does it have? So my question is, does it have like a gimmick or something, or is there something that is really cool about it?
Well, basically, imagine. Well, it does have a gimmick in the form of the drive button. You have, you know, small, medium, heavy attacks, and then a drive attack, which is unique for every character. It's, for example, with my favorite character in the game, Noelle Vermillion. The drive button will execute like a series of combos using like her revolvers. It's like if you press one button, it will do one attack. If you press this button and like back or whatever, you'll do like this like flipping forward gun attack. And for example, with another character, Ragnar the Blood Edge, who is basically the BlazBlue equivalent of Saul Bad Guy from Guilty Gear. Mm-hmm. It's like BlazBlue and Guilty Gear is like the spiritual successor to Guilty Gear. And with Ragnar the Blood Edge's drive attacks, every time you land a drive attack, it will suck up a little bit of health from the opponent and give it to you. So there's a different attack strategy for every fighter in the game. And Blaze Blue's characters, thanks to the story mode, it's like they really flesh out all of the details. You know, you have, you know, like Tao Kaka, who is this cat human like thing. And, you know, she wants to become a stronger warrior, but she also meets Ragna the Blood Edger, as she calls him, Ragna. And she also adds meow at the end of every sentence. You know, it's like she meets him in like a chance encounter outside of a Chinese restaurant, and he treats her to lunch and stuff like that. And there's like all sorts of little, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of like little, you know, characters. The characters are like interconnected to each other through like this event into this one. And after this character is beaten up, then this character will go off and face somebody else. Mm-hmm. And, another thing that makes, Blaze Blue Extend specifically so approachable is that they recreated the events of the first game. It's like they retold the story of Calamity Trigger. It's called Calamity Trigger Reconstructed. And that, you know, that if you're in a game that's, you know, pretty story driven, surprisingly for a fighting game, you know, being able to, you know, get caught up on the events of the first game without having to, you know, sit through and get the true endings and yada, yada, yada. It definitely makes the game more approachable, and it is the Blaze Blue to get. If you've never tried it, I highly recommend it. You know, Jeremy, I know you like fighting games, you know, on the Vita. I know you have Mortal Kombat, and we're eventually going to play Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I'd encourage you to at least give it a shot. Because, I mean, you know, it's not uber expensive. And the Vita version is really good. I think it supports cross-save, but don't hold me to it. I can't test it on the PS3 because, you know, I don't have one. But you can transfer your save to the network or whatever, and then download it onto the PS3. So
yeah,
there
like,
is the possibility.
Retro City Rampage kind of does the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there might be the cross save, you know, compatibility there. And, you know, one other thing I'll mention is I love the soundtrack to the Blaze Blue games. I think it's one of the best of the last several years. And it's done by Daisuke Ishibatari, who is – I know he's the creator of Guilty Gear. He might also be the creator of Blaze Blue, but don't hold me to it. And he, like, has composed all these character themes, and each one of them, it's like they're distinct. They're memorable. And, like, when you listen to them, you know, like on the special edition soundtrack CDs that came with Calamity Trigger, the first one had a 2-CD set. And then Extend had a limited edition with another CD. And it's like, when you listen to the music, you know, on the CDs or whatever, it's like each song has its own distinct flavor to it. And the production quality is just through the roof. It is one of my favorite soundtracks to listen to. It's like whenever I go out or whatever, usually I'll throw on, you know, either the Blaze Blue soundtrack.
I'm just thinking of, you know, how Guile's theme goes with everything.
Yeah,
that's for you, Blue.
Pretty much that. And the
making my breakfast.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, but yeah, I mean, the Blaze Blue soundtrack is one of my favorites of this generation, and I don't want to come off as a fanboy, even though I probably am, but you know, I would highly recommend checking out that franchise, Jeremy.
And P4 Arena while you're at it.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. Just make sure you finish Golden first, because that story mode does tend to get into spoilers. I picked it up when it was on sale for like $20 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've gone through the arcade mode, so I know sort of what's going on, but not a lot, because if I dive into the story mode, it's going to go – it takes place, like, I think it's like within a couple of weeks or like
2 months or whatever after the events of Persona 4. So I'm like waiting to finish up Persona 4 Golden before I really dive into Arena.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm still about halfway through Persona 1, so.
I'm playing the wrong one, Jeremy.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, it's BlazBlue Continuum Shift Extend. Yeah, it's I love it. It's one of my favorite fighting games of this generation. And I am looking forward to Chrono Phantasma. And I am a little bit nervous about it because so far from what I've heard, you know, they've gotten rid of a lot, you know, the vast majority of the stages from the first, you know, the first three, two, whatever, BlazBlue games. And that's kind of one of the things that I like about Extend so much is that, like, each iteration of BlazBlue expanded on the previous one. It's like, you know, with Calamity Trigger, you had like 12 characters and so many stages and whatever. Then comes Continuum Shift, and that's, you know, it's a sequel as far as the story goes, but they added like three new characters, and they added all sorts of music, and they added several new stages, and then I think they only lost like one song from the soundtrack, which was like a licensed track from the opening credits or whatever. And then with Extend, you know, they took all of the DLC characters from the standard Continuum Shift and included them in Extend. And they added the individual story chapters for each of the DLC characters, which, I mean, considering you can get, like, the standard edition of Extend for about the same price as the individual character DLC for the basic Continuum Shift, yeah, it's definitely a good deal.
Strong words.
Yeah.
We also got some strong words coming up with an interview. You guys ready for an interview?
Ready for an interview.
Okay, let's talk to Josh from movie. Robert here, and today I'm being joined by Josh Kay. Welcome to the podcast, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's jump right in and talk about Seize of the Day, which, without venturing into spoiler territory, is about a man's decision on his last day of life. It's a fairly existential concept, and one that's probably a little bit more contemplative than the average game. And I want to know, what was the impetus for the game?
Yeah, so it started a long time ago. I just started thinking about ideas for a game. I started out with the full motion video concept. And the first thing I really wanted to do was tell a story that had moral weight and mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I started to think about the technical aspects, it seemed like a day was kind of going to be a limiting factor, and kind of 30 minutes of time was about all I was going to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to think about how could I tell a story that worked within those kinds of limitations. And that's what drove me to the story that I'm trying to tell.
Okay. Now, given the scope of the storyline, you decided, sounds early on, to make this a full-motion video-based experience. And was this decision motivated more by finances or, you know, the ability of the medium itself?
It's a couple of things. Some is my ability. I'm not a programmer by nature,
sure.
So I'm limited to what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was also really inspired by my brother-in-law, who does independent film production. So he recently funded a project on Indiegogo for $5,000. The project's named Veil. And so I just got to talking to him a lot about what could be done with a limited amount of money. And you can really do a lot now with the quality of HD film equipment and a lot of passionate people that are trying to get their own stories out from a director's standpoint. So that was the inspiration for the full motion video.
Cool. Now, save for maybe a handful of curious recreations, you know, like Mad Dog McCree just made an appearance, and there's the upcoming Project Fedora. FMV really isn't utilized
too much these days. It seems to be out of favor for CG segments or even in-game engines kind of doing the heavy lifting of storytelling. So why do you think the medium kind of fell out of favor?
Well, you have the history back with Sega CD where those games were kind of failures. And part of it was the medium just wasn't prepared to handle those.
Sure.
CD is not really prepared to handle full motion video.
Mm-hmm.
And then the budgets were just ridiculous for some of those games. So they were spending $1 million to $3 million just on video production for those games, which it just doesn't make sense for those projects, and they didn't pay off. So that's kind of why they fell out of favor. They haven't been revived because it's not easy to do. I've spent a lot of time just getting to the point where I've gotten. There's plenty of developer resources out there for iOS, which is what I'm looking to develop for.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for information on how to actually make a full motion video game, there was nothing. I had to scrape together bits and pieces just because it hasn't been done.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's lots of things you have to do. I mean, you have to figure out how to tell a story. You have to write a script. The script gets very complicated because it's going to be branching all over the place.
Yeah.
So my computer room here at some point is going to have hundreds of 4x6 index cards laid out as I sit here and figure out how this path branches and loops back on each other. And then it's going to be an iterative process. So I'm going to start working with the director, and I'm going to say, this is my vision.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll come back and say, well, we can't do this, we can't do that. And we're going to have to work back and forth to figure out how we can make this project work. So it's definitely not going to be easy to do.
Cool. Now, you mentioned a branching narrative as part of the experience. And I wanted to know, right now, I know you're still in the drawing stages, but how long do you plan on making the average game last? And how many endings can players expect?
So what I'm targeting for the main playthrough is 30 minutes. So it's broken up into three acts of about 10 minutes each.
Okay.
And the idea is for most playthroughs to progress through the first and the second acts. So there'll be a couple of branches that'll terminate before you get to the end there, but the vast majority will get up to Act 3. And then Act 3 is going to have three major branches that branch off, and each of those is going to have multiple endings.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into specifically, like, different video that's playing at the end, it could get up to 20 or more different videos that are playing at the end. I'm committing to at least a dozen right now with the Kickstarter project. So I know there's going to be at least that many.
That's cool. Now let me dig into the mechanics of Seize the Day. What will be the input method used by players?
So one of the things I wanted to do is make it as accessible as possible and as simple for people to pick up and play as possible. So it's all going to be simple touch, so just one touch on the screen. And that'll make it possible. I mean, it's really exciting when I pitched this project, and my aunt, who is completely technical unsavvy, just got an iPad, never had a computer, sees the pitch project and understands it and says, you know what, I could play that game. But at the same time, I'm going to be able to do a lot with that simple touch. We can check the timing. So from the time an event starts to when you touch the screen, how much time has passed. Where on an object have you touched it? Which object are you touching in a scene? And then another thing I'm going to do is try to develop a profile behind the scenes and base actions based off of that. So let's say you develop a profile, and maybe the profile says that you're an impatient person. When you're talking with someone, they might pick up on that. And so they might respond to you with different conversation than if you were a more patient person in your profile.
That's pretty cool. Now, one of the things, going back to when I was a kid playing Dragon Slayer, I never knew what direction to push the joystick or hit the button. Will there be any kind of HUD or on-screen prompt, or will it be a little bit more of a organic experience?
So part of that will come out in testing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've done a little bit of testing already. I have a prototype out there that I've shown to people and asked them to play with it. And originally there was no HUD. It was just the video, and people didn't get it.
Yeah.
So there were two changes I made immediately. One was to change the background color when a scene is interactive. So there'll be a visual cue when the scene becomes interactive.
Okay.
The other thing is some kind of feedback when you touch an object that can be interacted with. So once you touch an object, it'll make a sound, and there'll be a slight fade in of a color on the object that you've touched. So you recognize immediately that, hey, I've interacted with an object, and the game recognized that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be experimenting with that a little bit further. Maybe it makes sense to highlight those objects before you touch them very slightly. Maybe giving the player the option to choose, do you want completely HUDless environment, or do you want to be able to see what you can touch?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure exactly how that'll work in the final game. It's something I'm going to test.
Cool. Similar to adventure game, sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Now, considering the focus of the game, it's your last day, I was thinking, I'm not sure if you have experienced it, but there's a Flash game out there called One Chance. And did you play that?
I have not. No.
Okay. The game examined your decisions. It's the last week on Earth. And one of the things about it, it was, in hindsight, there's a little bit of moralizing behind the decisions. And I wondered if Seize the Day will follow suit.
Yeah, so one of the things I'm going to be looking at designing, and I'm not sure if this will make it into the final game, is I'm actually going to score morality.
Okay.
And I don't know there's necessarily my place to do that, but I'm gonna put it in there, and I'm going to show it to some people, and I'm going to see what they think and see how that evolves. It's possible I'll end up with community-scored morality. So maybe people have the choice to say what they think the score for certain choices should be. And it's possible none of that works at all.
Yeah.
But the key thing is that there is an objective of seize the day. And so for each person that's playing, their objective is going to be to maximize the day how they want it to be maximized.
Hmm. Cool. Now, one of the things that you mentioned, you're targeting iOS devices, but are there plans to port the title to other platforms?
Yeah, so one of the challenges is that I'm developing this by myself. It's just me, and I've got limited programming background. So I've actually taught myself over the last year some Objective-C programming and iOS programming just to be able to do this game. And I'd love to bring it to any platform possible, but for other platforms, I'm most likely going to have to pay someone to do a port. So hopefully we start to reach my goal quickly here on Kickstarter, and I can start talking about stretch goals and looking to do that as quickly as possible. If it doesn't happen through the Kickstarter and at launch, I would definitely be looking to bring it to other platforms as quickly as possible.
Cool. Now speaking of, because you just mentioned the business model, do you have a an expectation of what the price of the app will be?
Yeah, so the expectation is going to be $5. Mm-hmm. So the starting backer amount is $5, which is basically a pre-order for the game. And that does a couple things. It's a high price, but at the same time, it commits me to a certain level of quality. So I've got in my mind that I need to make this game worth $5 to people. And I think that's something that I really want to target and is worthwhile trying to achieve.
Seems fair for, that kind of experience. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you is on the Kickstarter page, I found it interesting. You call Seize the Day a game rather than something else like a interactive experience. Maybe that's a little bit too generic. And I don't mean to discount the concept in any way. And this may be more of an issue of semantics. But I want to ask you, where's the division in your eyes between a game and, say, an interactive movie?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot more now. I recently started following the Game Police on Twitter, and hopefully I'll get his opinion on this at some point. And I just recently started playing Proteus, and I don't think that's a game. But one of the key things that I think makes it a game is there is a definite objective, and the objective is to seize the day. And there's going to be player agency in how you go about achieving that.
Okay.
So I think that's the one key thing that makes it a game. There's also, I think, you're going to see through the story that the player really does feel like they have a choice and they're directing the action, and that it's not just playing out through just a couple limited number of options. And I talked a little about the profile. The profile, as I start out designing it, is actually going to be stat-based. So there's probably going to be like a charisma stat, a speed stat, and those kinds of things that direct the action. I may not end up with those behind the scenes. I might come up with set profiles that kind of tie to, but that's how I'm going to be designing it, with actually stats attached to it.
Cool. Now, one question, hate to be the gray cloud there, but right now Kickstarter has about a 43% success rate. You kind of mentioned a contingency plan for Seize the Day. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, alternate platforms?
Yeah, so I started this project really as a learning experience for me. I currently work in the game industry, and I said, for my future learning, if I want to get to a certain level in the company, what can I do to help me get there? Mm-hmm. And I thought it'd be really cool to develop a game to get the experience behind that. And I'm learning a ton as I go through this. Mm-hmm. So it really is about the learning experience for me.
Cool.
And so I'm trying to learn as much as I can right now.
Mm-hmm.
If the project fails, I'm going to look for my next best opportunity to learn. And I don't know what that is. It might be, I might decide, hey, I want to write this story as a book, which would mm-hmm. be really easy to do on my own, and then maybe try again after that. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I just put it aside for a while and work on something else. But I'll come to that when it's the time to think about it.
Cool. One last question. If you could tell us where the project is right now. I know the 24th of the month is the last day for funding.
Yeah, so the 24th is the last day for funding, and that's really driven around my timeline. I want to try to get this game out by October, so mm-hmm. I kind of set an aggressive goal. I did a very short time window, mm-hmm. and so I wanted to kind of force myself to make a commitment to get this done. I didn't want it to stretch out. I'm very goal-driven, and I don't want to waste time sitting there thinking, is this going to get done or not? I want to know and move on. So that's why I've got 17 days to go as of right now.
Okay. And where can we go to finance FooMovie's effort?
So you can go to Kickstarter.com. You can mm-hmm. search for either FooMovie or Seize the Day. Mm-hmm. You can also go to my website, which is www.foomovie.com, and there's a bunch of information there and forums to start talking about the project.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time, Josh, and best of luck.
Thanks for having me.
I think it's time for trivia.
I think so, but I just want to say I believe that full motion video gaming really needs to make a comeback, like in a big way. I think, I think we need to go back to, you know what? In fact,
Night Trap. Matt,
yeah, that's right. And, you know, didn't Mad Dog Dupree just come out or something? And they have,
I played
know, all
the hell
kinds
out
of.
What was the Top Gun knockoff? Something Alley. Tomcat Alley? Yeah.
That sounds right.
I had a Sega CD. I won in a fighting game competition.
Really?
Yeah. I was pretty.
Is it Eternal Champions?
What was it? No, I think I want to say it was like Mortal Kombat. Yeah.
In fact, somebody should do a console. So you know the Ouya is coming out, like the Android base. Somebody should kickstart a console that is purely made. It is designed from the ground up to play full motion video games.
Like
what
a,
do you think?
Like a Sega CD reboot?
Yeah, I guess so. I was going to say, do you think I could get funded for that? But I guess Sega CD kind of did.
As long as it has a 32X, Jeremy, I'm on board.
All right.
Hell yeah.
I could play Chuck Rock 2, Son of Chuck.
Kickstart a new Tower of Power.
There you go.
Too sweet to be sour, funky like a monkey. Ooh, yeah.
There's the slogan. And let's do some trivia. Question number one. This week marks the release of Visceral Games' third iteration in the Dead Space franchise. Whether known by their previous moniker, L.A. Redwood Shores, or by Visceral, name the game that the studio isn't responsible for. Is it A, The Godfather, The Game, B, The Simpsons Game, C, GoldenEye, Rogue Agent, or D, The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King? A lot of these.
Wow, that is a lot of these.
Oh. Wasn't GoldenEye... which GoldenEye was it?
Rogue Agent.
Or if you'd use the internet spelling, it's GoldenEye Rouge Agent. Which is about James Bond cross-dressing and solving, you know, international espionage missions.
And looking like a bat.
Man, I don't know. I was hoping that you were gonna say like what was the God of War one based on? Oh, didn't we just talk about it? Dante's Inferno.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because they did that one, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I was hoping you were gonna say that, so I'd have at least one easy elimination.
Make it easy for you, Jeremy. You got to work trivia.
What was the old name of the studio?
EA Redwood Shores.
Redwood.
I'd almost
no clue.
Be tempted.
You'll find somebody, no clue in that. redwood shores.
Well, I'm just trying to think what sounds familiar.
With the Simpsons game, that seems rather different from the other three. The other three seem like what they'd
they're
be.
They're like serious, like movies tie-ins and stuff like that, like very cinematic.
Kind of up their alley.
I like that rationale. I'm going with that. Stealing your
idea. I'll agree.
You'll agree with your own idea? Excellent.
My one personality agrees with the other one.
Hey, Tyler. Correct answer, C, GoldenEye. Rouge
Agents.
That was made by EA LA, not Redwood Shores. Sorry, Jeremy.
EA LAME.
F you. Number two, anyone who's played the first Dead Space likely won't forget the creepy corridors of the USG Ishimura. Just what does the ship's name mean in Japanese? A, Eternal Rest. B, Stone Garden. C, The Welcome Outsider. Or D, Honorable Life.
Wow, that's a really good question.
That is a damn good question.
Thank you.
I'm trying to tap into my very, very limited knowledge of Japanese.
Yeah, mine too, and it's not coming out. But I think that the most ironic one would be the very first one.
I'm going to go with D.
Correct answer, Stone Village.
Whatever.
Whatever.
This is stupid. What did I say 2 seconds? Did I say that was a good question? It's a stupid question.
Fucking thing sucks.
Winning. Speaking of translations, this week Foster City-based Sanzaro Games delivers their take on the Sly Cooper series with the release of Thieves in Time. Where does the studio's name reference, or what does the studio's name reference? A, the Japanese legend of the three wise monkeys. B, a fable about the polite Kappa, who was eluded because they couldn't refuse an offer to bow. C, a woman who can shapeshift into a fox. Or D, a legend about an attractive woman whose neck can stretch to extraordinary lengths at night.
Oh my god.
You know that one?
Tentacles involved?
Always.
Yes! what was the studio's name again?
Three Monkeys, the Kappa.
The studio's name was Sanzaro?
Yes, Sanzaro.
I mean, everybody knows Sanrio, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be the obvious one, but I thought that the other one was the obvious one, and I was wrong.
Well, let's see, there's Sanyuki on the PS1, and that featured a monkey that was, I think it was similar to the origins of Dragon Ball.
Well, San means three, Ichini-san. So Zaro means monkey, but I don't know if Zaro means monkey. Three monkey? I don't know the Japanese word for monkey.
It does sound right.
Yeah, right. But I bet he thinks we would think that.
You guys, I'm still here. Don't talk about me when I'm listening.
Shut up, Robert. We're talking about you.
All right.
The San part does make sense.
I'm going to sacrifice blue to A, and then I'm going to choose
the Kappa.
What is a Kappa?
The little frog creature that
has a bald spot,
like Kuroki or whatever.
But they actually have water on the top of their head, so if they bow, they dump their water, and then they can't move till you refill them.
Man, that stuff is so messed up. Why do they have such weird?
You never seen Kappas in? Anime.
In real life, just walking around?
Yeah, just walking around. They're nice little turtles.
Yeah.
Turtle-like creatures.
No, I haven't seen
turtle,
that.
Turtle, frog kind of thing. So. Okay.
So there was one about the woman with the neck, and there was another woman. What was the other woman?
She's a fox.
See, there are a lot of things about
that. See you later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll sacrifice blue to A, and then I'll go with the foxy lady.
Foxy.
Not sacrifice if I'm diving in head first.
Correct answer. Three wise monkeys.
Yeah!
Good job, Blue. But you know what? At least I'm going out with the foxy lady. I'll see you guys later.
All right. Enjoy yourself. Yeah. Name the one game from the following list that Sanzaro didn't have a hand in making. This is question number four. Ninja Reflex, Secret Agent Clank, Mystery Case Files, The Malgrave Incident, or DreamWorks Superstar Karts?
You said did not?
Did not.
They were involved in three of those?
Yes.
Jeez.
That's weird.
Can you name the other game that didn't make the list?
Dude, no way.
The Sly Cooper HD collection. So that one would be too easy.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So again, Ninja Reflex, Secret Agent Clank, Mystery Case Files, Malgrave Incident, or DreamWorks Superstar Karts?
Ninja Reflex, was that Ninja Gaiden wannabe, or am I thinking of something else?
It was ninja minigames, like throwing stars. And
actually, ironically, it wasn't about ninjas at all. I'm going to go with the car racing one.
I think I'm going to go with, what was the mystery
games? Case Files, the Malgrave Incident?
Yeah, that's it.
Correct answer, DreamWorks Superstar Karts.
Oh, yeah. Crap.
It seems like you have to have like some pretty specific skills to make a racing game. And
it seems that way.
Well,
especially on the Nintendo 64.
Like, not a lot of studios will just say, you know what, screw it. We're going to make a racing game. We're just going to do it. It seems like you kind of have to. I mean, you can't do, like, a finding puzzle, you know, a searching game and a, you know, platformer and a, you know, you don't just ninja decide, like, I'm going to do a racer. Yeah, ninja. I mean, you know, the expansive.
I like your line of thinking.
I mean, I could have just as easily been wrong, but that's how I decided.
Yeah.
Seems like a really obscure title to pull out, too. Crap, that should have been obvious. Damn it!
So this week also marks the release of We Sing 80s. Name the notable and exclusive feature of the Nordic Games published series. A, it supports 4 microphones. B, it plays the actual artist music video. C, the game allows non-players to make certain requests of the performer. D, players can customize the timing and pitch of songs to personalize them and, quote, make them their own.
Wait a minute. If there's a quote in there, that means it's almost guaranteed to be it, isn't it? Well,
which one was the quoted one? Was the quoted one make it their own?
You guys analyze that. D was the quoted one.
Oh. Because I kind of feel like it's the one where they make requests. Like, they're like, pat your tummy.
Stand on your head.
Yeah, or whatever. That seems like the kind of thing they would do.
Pull down your pants and sing a cappella.
I mean, the thing is, if you get a girl you like in there, you can like make her do anything when she's singing and just tell her to do all kinds of stuff. That's a quick dating tip from yours truly.
That's entertainment.
Oh, yes. That's what I'm going
with. It's kinky night in the Lamont household.
It's always kinky night.
Just the days with why.
Yeah, well, I'm usually not here, but it's,
you know. Uh-oh.
Correct answer. Supports 4 microphones.
What? Come on.
Worst trivia ever.
That is the least kinky of the available choices.
So. No, it's not the worst trivia ever. That one was Madden 13. And
no, that was Madden great. No, he found really interesting things for that trivia. I seem to remember really liking that one.
No, you hate
it. I mean, I probably got them all wrong. Right in the middle. I hate that one.
You're about to walk out on it.
Did I go on a diatribe about that one, too?
Yes, you did. I think you
did. I think we're both praying for death at one point.
Let Jeremy win. Let the Wookiee win.
Take the podcast hostage diatribe.
Yes. We got a question in our mailbag from Alex Shearer. Do you think that Sony is going to legitimize the move, or do you think they're going to drop it and try to be the next Kinect? Jeremy? You're the
movie. I want to hear what you guys have to say, because I have a little bit of a different take on this.
So do I. I don't think Microsoft really dropped the Kinect. I think it has a very limited use now for voice recognition, exercise games, things like that. Sony, I'm not seeing them bring out as much Move software. I would like to see some digital distribution. You know, it's just some low-key games. They had that, Jeremy, help me out. What was that one where you stacked blocks and you kind of pulled them out? And
Jenga?
No. Yeah,
it's like a virtual Jenga.
Well, except it was like they would do it in 3D space and stuff. Yeah. There was like, you know what?
Little things like that I would like to see. Obviously, the development costs weren't through the roof and it kept Move relevant. I would have liked to seen that. Do I think they are going to carry Move into the next generation, much like Kinect? No, I don't think so. So.
You know, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the PlayStation 4 reveal is. see if they actually are going to use the move. If do you think there's the possibility that the PS4 will be compatible with the Move controllers that are already out?
I mean, there's always a possibility. How high do I rank it? Pretty low.
I think that's a really astute question, because in terms of like backwards compatibility, what are they gonna carry forward? I mean, is it gonna be, first of all, is the software gonna be compatible? Are the controllers gonna be compatible? How are you gonna interface with this thing?
Yeah, because you go, you know, you got PS1 compatibility, PS2 via software, you know, games that you purchase. PS3 games, there's a lot of compatibility.
Stream it all, download through their Gaikai service, whatever it is they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my thought about this. I'm going to answer a question with a question in true Hebonics form. I don't understand exactly what legitimize the move means. So I won't try and explore that, but I have a question for you guys. How many PlayStation Move compatible titles do you think have been released?
20.
Off the top of your head.
20.
Okay.
I'm going to say, I'll say 33 for an even number.
That's a very good specific question. Dear listener, come up with a number in your head. How many Move compatible titles were released? I will tell you. In fact, I think this number is low. I'm looking at a list right now. In fact, actually, there are conflicting reports of this. Wikipedia says there are 110.
What?
Wikipedia has a list of 110 Move-compatible titles.
Well, Wikipedia's entries on Cowboy Bebop are Spike died. This is a story about how Spike dies, and by dying, he dies and stuff like that. It's kind of I read it on the internet. It has to be true.
Yeah. 100, but they have an actual list here, so that's at least something. 110 is low, though. Another website that I really like, going to plug someone else's website if that's all right, Beagle, iwaggle3d.com, which specializes in 3D and Move. You know, they maintain their own list. They actually list 182 games there. And actually, they list 220.
Wait. Jeremy, I'm looking at the Wikipedia list. There's a lot of TBAs on there.
Well, what they say is, see, and I'm not even sure if at the top of the list, if you look at the very top, they say how many are pending. Let's see, they say
upcoming games
18. Yeah, I don't know, but they list them here: 48 multi-platform, 62 PlayStation Network games, 17 upcoming, or PlayStation Network games 17, upcoming games 18. But like I said, this other list, 180 from iWaggle3D, and I don't even think that. In fact, take a look, Robert. Do a Control F. See if you can find. There's a game that you and I have been talking about playing, right?
Galgun. Oh yeah, Hotshots.
Yes,
that's not in that list. So there are still things missing from this list, and I'm not sure that people are keeping it updated. But let's go with the conservative one. Let's say there are 110 of those.
Okay.
One of the things that I really like about the Move, just generally speaking, regardless of what it does, is I like the fact that it is so well supported. You know, I've got Donkey Kong bongos for my GameCube. I played that on like three games. I've got dancing mats for DDR. I mean, I've got like 10 or 12 games of those. I've just got all kinds of shit laying around my house. And I hate it that I can only play like two or three games with it. I really like with the PlayStation Move that I can pick up any number of games and have Move compatible. You know, they patched it into Heavy Rain. They patched it into, you know, we were talking about Hotshots. They patched it into all kinds of stuff. You can play them.
Patch it into Killzone too?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Killzone 3 has it. I mean, Killzone 2 didn't, but Killzone 3 came with it native. I can play a huge variety of software with that controller, regardless of what you think about it or how well you think it works or whatever. So in terms of legitimize, incidentally, just so we're on the level here, how many Kinect-enabled games do you think there are? Without looking, you've already looked, didn't you?
46. I am just guessing.
Blue?
No, I didn't look.
I'll go with 128.
You're close. 141.
Wow.
Yeah.
41 Kinect games. So I just want to point out to people out there, because I realize that not everybody likes these things, and I realize that we don't even, you know, really give them a lot of discussion. But in terms of the peripheral actually being supported, these are probably the most well supported after launch, post launch. In fact, there's another list here that I didn't even look at. How many Wii Motion Plus games do you think there are? You know what? The answer is actually really disappointing. There's like 20 of them. And so, you know, but Nintendo, you know, built and they continue to support the standard, you know, waggly, you know, PlayStation controller. I just like the fact that something that you buy can be integrated into so many different games. I just like that.
But on the on the Wii front, Garfield Show, Threat of Space Lasagna is... It's Wii Remote Plus compatible.
I'm not here to I'm not here to try to tell you that the quality of all 100 and some odd games is, sure. is good. But just the fact that they are supported. And you know what? And I think that's worth considering. I mean, the fact that we are in you know, a console generation that these things can be launched after the release of the console, but substantially after. I mean, years after the thing came out, and still have that kind of support. I think is really kind of cool, and I think it shows that developers are at least interested in it. I don't think that you can say that, you know, oh well, Sony made all those guys put that in, or oh, Microsoft mandated everybody's got to have this Kinect. I think that people really want to make those games, and I think people really want to have those kinds of experiences, dancing games. I mean, all kinds of stuff. I don't think
gun games. I think are
yeah, gun games. Well. I mean, you know, for the move, I mentioned Mad Dog McCree. There's that one, but there's also the what's that Quick Draw game that came out? I mean, there's you know, the Resident Evil Dark Side Chronicles.
Time Crisis one.
Time Crisis. I mean, there's just all kinds of Dead Space Extraction had it. I mean, just getting
Super Scope 6.
Yeah, I mean just yeah, that's yeah, I've got my what's Bazooka. I talked to my Devastator or whatever that is, my shoot the ants off the pizza game. I'm looking at it right now. I don't know why I still have that thing sitting around here.
I played Super Scope 6 yesterday.
Yeah, see, everybody loves that. I mean, it's coming back. Super Scope confirmed. PlayStation 4 Super Scope. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out. You know, not necessarily even to prove a point or to do it. You know, but just I didn't know those were the numbers. Somebody asked me that question just last week, and I'm like, I don't know, 50 or 60. I mean, I knew there were a bunch of them, but I had no idea that there were, you know, over 100, over 150, you know, games for that particular peripheral. Whatever form, and I feel like that probably going forward, I don't think they're going to drop that initiative. Whether those things are supported in their current form, because I think they can do better with that too. I mean, one of the downsides about the Move, since the listener specifically mentioned the Move, I mean, one of the drawbacks about the Move is that it I think it takes a little more setup. You know, you have to have a camera, you have to have your pieces. I mean, the neat thing about the Kinect is, you know, you got one piece, it plugs in, and you know, away you go. Of course, I realize doing push-ups and stuff like that, you know, there may be some tweaks that might fall.
They left off one on Wikipedia: heavy fire shattered spear
for the Kinect.
PS3. Yep. No, for PS3.
Oh, really? Heavy? Yeah. Is that the one that's the PopCap game?
No, Heavy Fire Afghanistan was the first one. It was a Polish-developed gun game. Very good, but the sequel allegedly was coming out this week.
Well, that's how I knew, because I had searched actually through this, because I was like, I wanted to know, because I really trust this other website in terms of, you know, things. And I was like, well, that's weird that they have a different number, and I've just kind of noticed that stuff is missing. So, I mean, obviously it's telling that people don't even really want to update the wiki about it. You know, obviously it's not, you know, but I think that it's probably incorrect to say that they're just going to say, well, I guess that didn't work. That was a stupid experiment. Why did we think that would catch on? I think it's going to be exactly the opposite. I think that you're going to see, you know, again, trying to just expand our lexicon of ways that we can interact with our games. I think that we're going to see something like Move, even if it's not Move itself, moving forward. But, you know, looking back on it though, even if they don't implement, you know, Move as it is, you have a lot of stuff to choose from. Even if Kinect isn't built into the next Xbox, you have a pretty...
It will be.
Yeah, you have a pretty decent number of things to be going forward, a decent number of things that are already there that you can play as it is right now, and then going forward, you know, who knows, will it be backwards compatible? You know, I don't know. But anyway, whether that answers the listener's question or not, I don't know, but I thought it was just an interesting talking point.
Any sort of predictions for the PS4 announcement? Any surprises, game announcements? I mean, the rumor is the controller is going to have like a capacitive touchscreen from like the back of the PS Vita on the front.
Oh God! I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, the
back of the Vita Touch is just—I've never really used that. Half the time, I have to turn that off in games because my hands are big. I accidentally touch that, so I'm just afraid my fingers are going to be resting and I'm going to set off something. my smart bomb.
I might accidentally.
Well, supposedly it was going to be like, supposedly it was going to be like right along where the like the start and select button are. It's like they're it's going to replace that. The rumors to be believed.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of weird stuff about it too, like the sharing. I mean, the thing is that it's all.
I think it's really weird that Sony, I mean, if this does take place later on this month, they said, no way, you know, we're going to let Microsoft take the lead. There's no benefit in going first. And then they turned around, they did a 180, and now all of a sudden they're making their announcement.
Do you think they're getting their shit together? I mean, it seems like last...
No. I mean, really, look what, you know, the Vita... they really haven't done much with the Vita. I don't think it's going to go anywhere anytime soon.
I don't know about that. Did you see the Killzone announcement?
Yeah, there's
you can knife people in the crotch.
Yeah.
How many Vita games do you think have been released, Robert? No, I'm just kidding.
How many Vita games are you looking forward to, Jeremy?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I'm not even sure that I'm really looking forward to the PlayStation 4.
Okay.
I mean, people ask, like, are you excited? Like, yeah, you know, I'm right. Like, I'm okay with it. I'll probably get more excited as it goes. I mean, my only problem is they're doing this thing on the 20th, which is like a Wednesday or something. I'm like, shit, I'm going to be going to have to call in sick, or I'm just going to have to watch it from work in a minimized window or something. But, you know, as they start showing things, I mean, sure, I'll get excited. I mean, it's fun whenever a new console gets released. But could I go another year with the, you know, I mean, I've got stuff to be playing. I've got thousands of hours of stuff that I haven't even played with.
Well, my worry is just, Sony, as we mentioned at the very beginning of the show, they just haven't marketed. They haven't offered the push for their PS3 titles. Mm-hmm. And the Vita, they haven't, and I think you'd agree with me, Jeremy, they haven't really pushed it properly.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, that's really...
Isn't there? And they're coming off those two elements. And, you know, we're supposed to get excited about this new system. Yeah, you know, great hardware, just like the Vita, but... What's going to drive it? Really compelling software. They need to have that. And early launches always worry me. Look what happened to the Vita. Look what happened to the Wii U.
The Vita had a great launch. I don't care who you are. The Vita had a great launch.
I played the majority of the games already, Jeremy. We already
went
through this.
And I still stick by it. The Vita had one of the best launches of possibly any platform ever.
Well, if you can overlook the fact that a lot of the big games were ports, I mean, it was a pretty decent lineup. Definitely better than what the 3DS had to offer.
That's a big if. If you are a PlayStation 3 owner, PlayStation 3 fan, you've played a majority of the games. And, you know, it wasn't an awful launch, but they could have done a little bit better. They could have made those really compelling games right out the gate. And backed it up with the next couple of months.
Well, you know, I mean, there has been, you know, several, you know, a wave of Vita announcements recently. I believe Axis Games, who also published Blaze Blue, announced that Muramasa Rebellion, I want to say, something like that.
Another port.
But with this one, it's getting a jump button. Going back to when we were talking about jump buttons earlier in the show.
Yeah, jump button that does nothing.
Well, actually, this jump button actually does jump.
Oh, well, I guess there's that.
But I think Xseed also announced, I think the Yeez game that's coming out over in Japan or is out over in Japan or whatever is coming over here.
That will Sean buy one again.
And, you know, I mean, Dead or Alive 5 Plus was announced a couple of months ago. And that's actually shaping up to be, you know, hopefully as good as the... you know, as good as I'm expecting it to be. It's going to run at 60 frames per second and have, you know, cross-play and cross-buy with the DLC that you've purchased for the PS3 version. So, I mean, there's some stuff on the horizon for the Vita that's looking good. I mean, it's...
But do you feel honestly, solid? Do you feel like Sony is really behind the Vita? Do you feel 100%?
Not 100%, but I mean, it's...
Well, give me a number. 50, 60...
Well, I mean, of course, there's also that that announcement of Soul Sacrifice, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Soul Sacrifice is coming out on April 30th, I want to say. I mean, it's like that now that it's like now that we're into 2013, it's like they're starting to show some support for it. I mean, it's I'd probably say it's maybe about 60, 65, something like okay. that. I mean, it's
Is that enough to instill an air of confidence in you for their new system, though?
Honestly, I think the biggest problem with the Vita is still the price. It's not the games. I mean, what it does have is good. It's just that damn $250 and $300 price.
See, I think for the hardware, it's still a really good deal. I think it's an amazing piece of hardware.
And me too. I agree. It's arguably the best portable that I've played, and it makes the PSP 2000, 3000, whatever, look like a toy.
Sure.
I mean, it is a really nice piece of hardware, but you know, when you're talking about going up against the 3DS, which is like what I think it got the basic version got didn't it get price dropped down to like 140 now?
Yeah, I saw an XL for 169 recently.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a huge margin. I mean that's.
It has a much better screen, does more, you can play movies on it, or movies at least you own. It does a lot more. I don't think the price is an issue. I think $250, yeah, if they could knock it down or throw in some software, that would be it. I really think the issue is the lack of really compelling software.
Well, yeah, I mean, it does have a lack of software, but, if you dig portable versions of, home console games, portable fighting games, I mean, it's definitely it has a decent lineup.
Right.
But, it's like when you're talking about spending, $250 or $300 on it, it's just like, that's kind of out of my budget, It's just doesn't seem like cheap enough to take a risk on it.
I do think if you factor in PS Plus, especially new buyers, they can spend $5 a month, get 4 or 5 free games, that kind of pays for itself.
Oh yeah, I mean it's definitely nice hardware, but if my family member wasn't able to get one for $100, I probably wouldn't have had any interest in getting it at $300 or something like that. I mean, they really need to give some sort of an incentive to the casual buyer. The 3DS is like $140, but for this, it's like you get so much more. They need something that's really compels people to pay that much more, and they can't really do it. They need that. They need a price drop to put it at least within competition with the 3DS. I mean, it's not even a competition now. The 3DS has had what, 2-3 official price drops? Since it came out, and
But do you think that makes for a healthy platform?
Well, I mean, the 3DS is doing a hell of a lot better than the. I mean, the 3DS is doing a hell of a lot better than the Vita, and I mean, Super Mario 3D Land is on track to outpace the original Super Mario Galaxy. It's doing very well. I mean, it's selling.
But again, I think that's software.
Well, I mean, software helps with it. I mean, it's software plus the price tag on the system. And right now it's, the software, if there's a couple of games, that are interesting, you have to look at the price, if you have a couple of games and like the price is like on the system is like $149 or something like that, it's like, that's kind of reasonable. I can kind of take a chance on it. But when you're talking about $250 to $300 and you're only maybe interested in a couple of, maybe like half a dozen games or whatever, it's really hard to pull the trigger. It's, you kind of have to look at the 3DS and say, well, for $140, I can get this and half of a library of decent games, right out of the gun.
So bottom line, Sony needs to bring out the Fleshlight attachment.
Oh, hey, that would work. Dead or Alive 5 supports the Fleshlight attachment, game of the century.
The new move. You are the controller.
Yes, the inverted move.
You are the joystick.
On that note, take us home, Blue.
Well, let's see if I can scroll down to the appropriate place in the outline. If you liked what you heard today, you'll probably love what we write. Head on over to tech-gaming.com for the latest reviews, previews, discussions, and new release info. And check us out on Google Currents, where you can read us without the ads. Always a good thing.
You can also follow us on Twitter at...
I'm Robert Allen, at @tech_gaming.
And...
I am at @Jeremy_Lamont.
And I'm at Blue Swim, BLUESWIM, and yes, I am full of BS.
So, unfollow on that... people that weren't here tonight. That's at Sean Nola.
Did you say unfollow the people?
Yeah, that unfollow. Were...
Yeah.
At Sam Rage. I'm kidding. Man. I'm dumb. Good night.
Good night.
And
everyone.
On that note, adios.